Good afternoon. Ready to start this meeting. Thank you everyone for coming. This is really an important issue for California, and I think it's a great opportunity to have a full discussion. First, I want to provide just a little context about what today is. Today's workshop is focused on presenting the California Independent System Operators staff proposal. Proposed principles for governance of a regional ISO. We are holding this workshop to provide the stakeholder community an opportunity to learn more about the ISO staff proposal and to discuss it. State law established through SB 350 requires the evolution of the California Independent System Operator from a California-centric to a regional organization, or at least permits it. And as part of this process, today's workshop is informational. No decisions will be considered, as this is a transparent window into an open discussion about a regional grid. Like today, there is a similar workshop in Denver on Monday. Eventually, the California Independent System Operator will finalize its proposal, taking into consideration the comments you provide today. Before we get into details, I want to make sure people are clear on a couple of things. First of all, today's workshop is not really going through a detailed assessment of the benefits. That will occur next month. The California Independent System Operator has put out a study that's certainly fairly impressive on the potential benefits. But again, that will come up later. I think in the context of today's meeting, certainly we all have in mind the benefits that have been demonstrated by the energy imbalance market, which, frankly, this regional market would basically take the energy imbalance market and put on steroids. But again, I think today's discussion is to really focus on the ISO staff proposal. Before we get into the details, I wanted to remind everyone of the big picture. First and foremost, California is addressing the challenge of climate change. And that's certainly the top priority of this administration. In late May, the governor, Mary Nichols, and I had the opportunity in San Francisco to meet with the energy ministers from around the world at the Clean Energy Ministerial, and also to meet with subnationals from around the world at the Clean Energy Ministerial. It's a great opportunity to have that dialogue about the other participants in the U.S. and also around the world. And this was basically a follow-up to Paris. And I think, again, it sort of emphasizes the changes that are going on. First, I would, in passing, always need to remind people that looking at greenhouse gas emissions in California, transportation is the issue. It's basically double the power sector. So it's really incredible that, as we talk about the power issues, we don't lose sight of the big picture. What are we doing on transportation? But in the power business, it's a great time now. You know, and that was certainly the message coming out from the Clean Energy Ministerial. If you look at the changes in pricing on LEDs, on onshore wind, and also photovoltaic, it just really opens up the opportunities for the world in terms of changing the power sector and basically what I call the renewable revolution. Having said that, it was interesting talking to our German colleagues where we have similar policies and similar issues. And actually the way they summarized our approach was as technology focused, while they characterized their approach as market focused. Today's not the time to get into exactly how they get to that conclusion, but it's certainly an interesting characterization. In terms of, again, everyone talks a lot about the challenges of low-cost LEDs, PV, onshore wind mean, but there's also been a revolution in the technology on the transmission system and the grid operation system. And that's really what this is all about. If you look at the implications of sensors technology, if you look at the implications of software, synchrophasers, smart inverters, microgrids, in the transmission and distribution operating systems, it just really is time to move the grid operations to the 21st century. And for those of you wedded to the 20th century, the old control room, you're dinosaurs, it's the bottom line, and you got to get used to it. I think part of the way to think about the revolution is that my iPhone now actually has more capability than the state's mainframes had in the 70s when I was first in public service. So that advance in computing power is certainly part of what allows us to talk much more about a regional grid. But as you go through the technology changes, we really have to look at what it means for the physical market, physical systems, the market systems, and the regulatory structure. And they have to move fast. Much of California, along with the rest of the West, is operating under an outdated power operating system model. While much of the U.S. is already operating under modern transmission systems, in the West, we still have a balkanized power operating grid made of 38 different balancing authorities. For contrast, when I was in China, China has four balancing authorities. Germany has four, although when I talk to them about it, they say it's an historical legacy, that they probably should only have one. So again, 38 is not a magic number. We just need to do better, and we need to operate more efficiently the Western grid. Just the world's changed a lot in the last 20 years. And the ability to integrate and dispatch more renewable energy is at our fingertips. But we really need to deal with the sort of operational systems. We were at the ISO symposium. Again, Travis Cavola characterizes it as an IT. I mean, there's a lot of philosophical or almost religious arguments about these issues. But really, we're talking about a modern IT system westwide. And we're going to need that to deal with our 50% renewable goals, basically to address the greenhouse gas challenges we have. And it's long overdue to have this discussion of steps we need to take to modernize and integrate the physical operation of the Western grid. We know this approach should offer tremendous environmental benefits as well as cost savings, not just for California but for the entire West. And again, I'm pointing to that based upon the energy imbalance market, but we'll have much more detailed workshop on that issue at the end of the next month. So the question is not why we should do this, but how do we approach reutilization in a way that is fair, balanced, and addresses the needs of all the states involved? That's the purpose of today's discussion, and it's a huge issue. That's the purpose of this process. Now, I want to emphasize this is a transparent process directed by statutes laid out in Senate Bill 350. Everything presented in today's workshop is open to stakeholder input and feedback. We're certainly looking for comments today. We're looking for written comments later. All comments we receive will be posted, as well as our responses. And we encourage participation from a broad and diverse group of stakeholders. So thank you. President Picker?
I think that you laid it out very well. I just want to thank you for hosting this workshop and Kevin Barker of your staff for all the work that he did to put it together. And I'm looking forward to hearing panelists and public comment with great interest.
I want to thank everyone who's here and who's been working very, very hard over these last several months to help advance us in this process. People have been really rolling up their sleeves, and we really appreciate this. This is a follow-up to the workshop we had on May 6th that the CEC and the Governor's Office sponsored. We got a lot of excellent comments on that workshop, and we've incorporated those into the straw proposal principles that you'll hear today. This also reflects input we've been receiving from the parallel process that's going on in meetings with other state regulators from throughout the West and other governor's offices and energy advisors. And there's a similar workshop in Denver next week where we're going to also hear feedback. This is not the end of the process. There's going to be more public workshops, and then ultimately leading to the ISO presenting something to the governor, presenting it to the legislature, which of all those steps, and then we have additional public process. So we welcome your input and involvement here, and we look forward to the discussion.
I'll just say thank you. I'll echo the thanks in terms of putting together the workshop. I attended the May 6th workshop, and it was great to get the principles document because it did reflect a lot of the discussion, and there's a lot of interesting concepts in here that I'm interested in hearing more detail about, and so I'm looking forward to today's discussion.
Thank you so much for holding this this workshop again. It has been an incredible process, and I'll take this opportunity to make a few comments and echo some of the words that Commissioner Weisenmiller pointed out. It's true that this is really a movement towards regionalism in a context of greenhouse gas reduction, in a context of objectives of making our systems more efficient and optimizing optionalities, as our engineers used to say. It's an IT solution, and as we move to the 50% goal, undoubtedly regionalism will help us get there faster, more efficiently, and more reliably. And we need to focus on making sure that we do it and we do it right. This is something that, as you pointed out, is certainly prevalent in other parts of our country. The eastern part of the United States certainly has a lot of ISOs that are functioning, and they're certainly underscoring the fact that more renewables are being integrated in the grid. Point in case, MidAmerican announced that they were moving towards 80% wind power for Iowa with a goal of 100% ultimately wind power for Iowa, which would not happen but for an integrated market. Same thing in Europe. The Germans, of course, are very interconnected with Norway because they like to balance with Norway and their neighbors. The Europeans at COP21 were actually having meetings on a single common European market with very similar issues that we are dealing with, the crux of which is governance. And how do you make sure that you have equitable governance all across the states, and that Poland with their coal plants is not link what Switzerland and Germany and Norway does, and how do you balance those interests and allow for autonomy? Is it bottom-up or top-down approaches? And they actually pointed out, because I participated in those hearings, that they're looking at California and hopefully trying to find out solutions from us as well. Integration is happening across the board. There's a single balancing authority in Brazil as well as Argentina. They're talking towards integrating their systems so they can tap into each other's renewables and hydropower. So it is a concept that is totally, absolutely part of the energy revolution and part of the movement towards a technological revolution that has taken place on the IT factor as well. Apart from renewables, this just makes sense because taking those 38 balkanized regional authorities and making them more efficient because you have a central dispatch is going to be beneficial economically to everybody and certainly to California. We know the benefits of the EIM. I participated in the Transitional Committee for Governance for the EIM. We've kept an eye on it. The board has been involved and briefed by staff. Two of us, myself and Governor David Olson, were a part of the process. And it was certainly had its stops and starts, and we hit some bumps on the road, but ultimately the stakeholders worked well together, and we came up with a process that actually worked and can move forward. And again, regionalism in the context of what we saw at the Clean Energy Ministerial, of what our objectives are pursuant to SB 350, is very important. We need to get it right. Taking the time to get it right is important, as we have, and thank you everybody for working on it, and Cliff for having all the meetings and bringing in the other states. And we want to make sure that we're here to listen, acknowledge all the comments, and move forward in the best possible way, keeping California's interest private.
Thanks. So let's go to the first presentation.
So Chair Weisenmiller, if you don't mind, can I do a few housekeeping remarks? So I'll try and be brief. To let everyone know, this workshop's being recorded. A copy of the recording will be available on the Regional Grid Operator and Governance website a few days after the workshop, and a notice will be sent to the listserv. Information about this proceeding is generally sent to those who have joined the Regional Grid Operator and Governance listserv. There's a handout outside on the table in the foyer with instructions on how to join the listserv. On this list, only this listserv will receive emails on the topic. The agenda for today, as you have already heard from our dais, opening remarks from our dais, we will then move to a presentation from Stacy Crawley of the ISO, going over the proposed principles for governance of a regional ISO. We then will turn it back to the dais, starting with Governor Galitova of the ISO for comments and also for questions and comments from the dais. We then have a well-balanced roundtable panel moderated by Bob Foster. At that time, and that'll last for an hour and a half, at that time and only at that time will we take public comment. Our public comment period, for those of you in the hearing room, and if you'd like to make public comment at the workshop, please fill out a blue card. The blue cards are back there with Alana Matthews, our public advisor. Each speaker will have only 3 minutes to make oral comments. We will have a 3-minute timer on the screen for all commenters. However, we welcome written comments to our docket, which are due on July 7th by 5 p.m. When you step up to the podium to make comments, please introduce yourself and organization and speak directly into the podium microphone for those that can hear you, so those on WebEx can hear you. During the public comment period, after stakeholders in the room have made their comments, we will go to remote participation. California ISO staff, Christina Osborne here, she will go over those instructions shortly. And then for some emergency procedures, for those not familiar with our building, the closest restrooms are directly out this door and to your left before you get to the exit. We also have a snack bar located on the second floor under the white awning. Lastly, in the case of an emergency and the building is evacuated, please follow our employees to the appropriate exits. We will reconvene Caddy Corner here to this building at Roosevelt Park. Please proceed calmly and quickly, again following employees who you are with. And with that, I will first turn it over for instructions on WebEx.
Thank you, Kevin. My name is Christina Osborne. I work in the Stakeholder Process Group at the California ISO. I'm going to manage the web conference participation today. And as Kevin stated, there is a 3-minute comment period that will apply to the the comments that come in over the phone as well. And also a reminder to identify yourself before asking your question or commenting. If you do have a question, you can enter the queue by pressing #2 on your telephone. And if you decide to lower your hand, you can press #2 again. So, just so you all know, there's about 130 people on the web at this time.
Thank you. So with that, we will go to our first presentation.
Good afternoon, Andreas. This is Stacy Crowley. I'm the Vice President of Regional and Federal Affairs for the California ISO. I appreciate you allowing us to have the opportunity to present the proposed principles for regional governance of the ISO here today, and appreciate the dialogue that has occurred since this began several months ago. So my basic thoughts are today, I'm going to walk through some of the background that got us to the proposed principles. I'll walk through the principles and then talk a little bit about next steps. So some background on this effort, certainly Chairman Weisenmiller mentioned this in his opening remarks, but this is in part implementing some of the details around Senate Bill 350, in that the bill outlined, as stated here on the slide, that it is the intent of the legislature to provide for the transformation of the independent system operator into a regional organization. And to do that, they recognized that if there were benefits to California customers and its ratepayers, we would need to go forward with modifications to our current governance to allow for this regional ISO to take place. In addition, the language of the bill asked the ISO to conduct studies of the impacts of the regional market, looking at the overall benefits to ratepayers in a certain group of categories. And those categories are listed here on the slide as well, but they include the creation of jobs and economic benefits, the environmental impacts such as greenhouse gas reductions, the impacts to disadvantaged communities, and the reliability and the ability to integrate renewable energy into the system. So as Chair Weisenmiller also mentioned, those preliminary results are out. It's not the topic of the conversation here today, but we do have that information posted on our website, and we are getting data requests and comments back from stakeholders on these preliminary results. And those comments on the preliminary results are due on June 22nd, so we look forward to comments on that. So those studies indicated considerable benefits in the list of categories that the SB 350 bill lays out. And we believe that those are enough to continue forward with the discussion about governance modifications. And so we're doing that here today. We started that May 6th with a public workshop. And as Cliff Rechtschaffen mentioned, we've been having these parallel discussions with other state energy advisors and commissions. So in addition, the SB 350 language talks about what this transformation means and some of the parameters around that. And it states that it shall not alter compliance with state laws. It shall require the ISO to maintain its open meeting policy and public access to our public records. And that the transformation is voluntary for those utilities or balancing authorities that opt to do this, and it could potentially require approval from their state or local authorities, jurisdictional authorities to do so. So these are fairly obvious, but they were important to mention in this bill to keep front of mind. It also states in the bill, just procedurally, that the ISO would present both the study results and the governance modifications to a joint agency workshop, which would include the California Energy Commission, the California Public Utilities Commission, and the California Air Resources Board. So we plan to do that here later this summer. And then, as Cliff mentioned, that information would be transmitted to the governor, and the governor would transmit that to the legislature. So just a bit of background, and much of this was covered in the introductory remarks, but there has been stakeholder and engagement with state leadership on this topic for several months, and it really began several years ago with the energy imbalance market. The energy imbalance market was a tool that the ISO offered to balancing authorities in the West to take advantage of optimizing their energy resources within the hour. It's actually every 5 minutes. And that is just a piece of what the ISO does, but it was essentially, as was said here earlier, it's a technology tool that allows these balancing authority areas to optimize their resources, take advantage of any variations in the energy loads or demands, and do that openly and effectively with their resources, as well as sharing the resources of the other balancing authorities that are engaged. That that triggered the need to look at really the role and the ability for the region, which now expanded with PacifiCorp and now NV Energy are both participating in this market, to look at how the region can have a voice in something that is now multi-state in its operation. And so the EIM Transitional Committee that was created through a stakeholder discussion formed and created a governance proposal for energy imbalance market. That led to a lot of the basic foundational discussions about ISO governance in general. So it talked about really how the ISO board and its governance works now. It looked at other models from ISOs and RTOs around the country. We developed a matrix of both board committee structure and their committee makeup, including state regulator bodies, in two public documents that have been posted on our website and are available for you all to review. It helped the transitional committee understand the parameters and the ideas and the possible solutions to governance as it relates to energy imbalance market, but we're finding that it also provided some tools and some knowledge for this discussion on a larger regional ISO governance. So I think a lot of that groundwork was done and done well by the transitional committee and the work that was done there. Also, when it came to development of these proposed principles, they largely came from the work and the discussions from others around the West that have engaged in this conversation. In part, this whole concept of regional ISO governance modification not only came from the passage of Senate Bill 350, but it came from the interest of a balancing authority in the West to look at integrating their grid with the ISOs, and that was PacifiCorp. And they announced their interest in pursuing this in April of 2015 by signing an MOU with the ISO. In addition, they released a gross benefits analysis of the potential for this integrated market, and they did that in October of 2015, and that, again, revealed some considerable benefits both their customers and the ISO, and so that kept them engaged and wanting to move forward, which also was supported by Senate Bill 350 and the work that we need to do there. As Cliff mentioned, there have been ongoing conversations with state energy advisors, the governor's offices, and Western state regulatory commissioners for quite a while. In fact, the utility commissioners developed a committee under the Western Interstate Energy Board to look at energy imbalance and the governance issues there, continued to develop relationships amongst themselves, and really work quite diligently on looking at the components of governance for regional ISO that are important to them. And they have developed papers on that, as well as some continued dialogue on this going forward. They really, as Cliff said, roll up their sleeves and are wanting to find areas of agreement. And as we found out, or we discussed on May 6th, there were other papers that discussed concepts and principles around regional ISO governance. There was a paper sponsored by the Hewlett Foundation that Ron Binns presented that laid out a scenario or some ideas around regional ISO governance. The utility commissioners themselves put together some principles. Members of the public power community put together some principles. And since May 6th, NRDC has put together a paper, a really informative paper on structures of ISO governance and possible questions and analysis around that as well. So a lot of folks have given this thought, and we think that we represented a lot of the common components of governance principles into this paper. And really, it's our way to start to get feedback on these. And we know that it's not perfect. We know that it needs some of your input and thoughts and feedback, but it's a straw proposal, and that's what straw proposals do. They elicit the comments and the conversation. So I'm repeating myself a little bit, but this proposal does follow on the May 6th workshop. I think that was an important step to lay out the variety of conversations of principles either written by others or thought by others. And so we had the authors of some of the papers present at this May 6th workshop, and we had a panel of experts discuss and react to those papers, and I think that was very well received. We had great attendance both in person and on the WebEx, and we received over 20 comments in writing and have reviewed those and used those just to some extent in the development of these principles. So to get to the proposal itself, it's not a very long proposal because it is considered principles, and they are high level, although detailed enough to provide some assurances about the way and the direction that these principles are going. But again, it's an opportunity to elicit some feedback. There are eight really categories of principles that we developed, and they're on the screen, and I'll walk through each one of them to some level of detail, and then we can certainly open it up for questions. So an initial concept, which is sort of overarching, is the idea that the details of governance, these are principles, but the details of governance should be worked out through a transitional committee that's made up of a broad set of stakeholders, and that can be similar to the EIM transitional committee, can be a forum for public discussion about the details of governance. But we know that we need to have these high-level principles, one, for any potential legislation, and two, to give the transitional committee some direction. And we know that these principles need to be upheld as they look, as this transitional committee gets developed and looks at the details further down the road. It should be, again, made up of a broad set of regional perspectives. We don't detail what that looks like in this proposal, but we're looking for your feedback on what that looks like, the size and the makeup of that transitional committee. And we know that in general it should have broad stakeholder and probably state regulatory participation in that, and we look forward to, again, comments and details on that. We want the committee to work fairly quickly. We want this to be something that can be brought forward in the work that PacifiCorp is doing with their regulators. We want to make sure that there is some surety around governance as they look to get approvals through their state regulatory bodies to join the ISO, and we know that there's a timeline associated with that to get engaged as soon as possible. And ultimately, what the committee develops would be approved by the ISO board and would be implemented thereafter. A key principle that we heard from not only written comments and verbal comments and along the road is that the preservation of state authority is really key to ensuring that a regional ISO can acknowledge, respect, and adhere to the state policies each state that is within the ISO footprint. And so that means, and this is how the ISO works today within the boundaries of California, although I will mention that there is a small part of Nevada that's within our ISO footprint. Valley Electric is a small co-op that is served by the California ISO, that each state would retain its traditional authorities over procurement, energy policies, and resource planning as they do today, and that would not change in this regional ISO context. And as it stands today, the ISO, while it engages and collaborates with the state agencies on these topics, it really only reviews those elements for reliability concerns and make sure that they're aligned with the work that we do to maintain reliability and operations of the grid. So that, again, would not change. And I think it's important to recognize that every state had the same need, and I think as other multi-state ISOs do, they acknowledge and respect the state procurement and energy policies. So to continue on to this subject, we propose that the governing documents will really document that concept, and that it will prevent the ISO from adopting policies that diminish state authority in any way that they have now. And it would be, and it requires some significant approval to change this in our bylaws when we consider putting these into the state bylaws or into the ISO bylaws. Also, this was discussed often in our conversations with other states, is that there is sort of this notion that a capacity market could exist, but the ISO would never propose or endorse a capacity market, and this would be up to the states to determine. Another important topic that was discussed was the idea of in the case of California, maintaining its ambitious and greenhouse gas emission goals. And I think that's an important element to note in ISO governance. And what we would do, the ISO would develop a transparent methodology to track greenhouse gas emissions as they would come into California and either be attributable to California load or out-of-state resources that serve California load. Now, we do this now with the energy imbalance market. We created a methodology and a tracking system that essentially creates a bid adder to any resource that has greenhouse gas emissions in and then wants to serve California. So there's a way to track the energy that is imported into California in the energy imbalance market in terms of its GHG component. And I think that same or similar methodology could be utilized in a full regional ISO. Our team would be committed to developing such a methodology and make sure that it was transparent for folks to understand. And we understand that there's a lot of environmental regulations that other states have, and we also have the Clean Power Plan that's sort of unsure at this point. But we think that the regional ISO could also facilitate opportunities for states to comply or work with our methodology, work with our tools to help them comply with their environmental regulations, whatever they may be. We'll note that the EIM bid adder and the methodology to track that has yielded results that in the last 6 months, zero coal has been imported into the EIM market, into California through the EIM market. That's something we post monthly on our monthly market reports. And in those same months, the majority of the energy that's been imported into California has been renewable energy. So we are able to now start to track that and understand how successful the energy imbalance market is and really what resources are being utilized in that way. Another key principle was that participating transmission owners must have a clear understanding of their ability to withdraw from the ISO. I'll note that the ISO currently has a a provision for all transmission owners that they can exit with 2 years written notice. It's very simple, and I think other states and balancing authorities want to know that something similar would be the case with a regional ISO. So I think any change to that would need to go through a public process, and it'd have to be principled in its thinking, but we certainly understand that every transmission owner would need to understand and have a clear path to exiting should they so decide. And also we heard that that might occur through direction from their state or local regulatory authority, so that would need to be respected as well. So the idea of developing a regional ISO in terms of governance sort of yields, we have a current board now that is selected, appointed by the California governor and confirmed by the state senate. How do we transition from that to something that is more regional in nature? And so the proposal here is that there be an initial board that sort of allows the current board to stay in place. They have the institutional knowledge and the understanding of what's going on, but bring in other state selected members to serve as an initial board. So the way we're proposing it is you have our five-member board, and it will be joined by four new members selected by other states. Now, that selection process is not defined in these principles, but something that we know we need to discuss. Also, the initial board would start when governance documents are adopted by the ISO. Essentially, that would be the trigger event to begin this initial board to start the process. And also important to note is that the California board would constitute, the members of that board would constitute a majority for a certain transition period. And again, we weren't specific on a transition period, but again, that would be something to be discussed both in stakeholder comments and through the work of the transitional committee. And finally, new board members, the selection process for this after this initial board would be implemented over time. It could happen such that the initial board terms would expire and a new board would be brought in as those terms expire. There are several ways to do this. We know Ron Binns in his paper talked about a bicameral board as a transition. We know there are several ways to do this. This seemed to be the most straightforward in the proposals that we've seen. Then after the initial board was created and their terms started to expire, there would be a new nomination and approval process for the ongoing board that would be developed by the transitional committee. And I guess first we would look to the EIM governing body process as a model, as a good template to consider. It was, as Governor Galitva mentioned, it was a good process, and I think our board is still considering its candidates for the first EIM governing body members, but we think that the process itself was good, robust, and allowed for a lot of stakeholder input. So that's a good process, at least to consider as a template. And in that process, as we're suggesting here, that process should include a lot of stakeholder input and a role for the states in that nomination. And I think we received a lot of comments, and most all of them were supportive. But not all, were supportive of the fact that the board would be an independent board, a board that was selected by stakeholders, but they had no financial, I think in a lot of cases, or political connection with the market or elsewhere. And that is, we also have FERC independence requirements to make sure that we adhere to. And the nomination and approval process, again, is something that there's many ways to do that. We didn't propose anything specific here. There's certainly the nomination process that the EIM governing body went through. There's something that could involve states in the approval process where a stakeholder nominating committee could develop something and the states could have a role in approving that. But again, we look forward to your comments on that. Another key element of the principles was to really define the role for state regulators in the regional ISO context. And as I stated earlier, there are a lot of examples of this happening in other multi-state ISOs around the country. Stakeholders have seemed to find both the MISO, the Midwest continent or the mid-continent ISO as well as the Southwest Power Pool models to be most similar or at least most attractive in the context of a regional ISO here in the West. And so stakeholders, state regulators have really done their research on what those bodies within MISO and SPP do, and I think have really formed the basis for a lot of the principles that we're suggesting here. Both of those entities in MISO and SPP, they have a body of regulators that is incorporated essentially as a separate entity from the ISO, but they have a very tight relationship with the ISO. We are proposing that one regulator from each state and regional ISO footprint would serve on that body, and that there would be a seat for an individual from publicly owned utility that would have a non-voting seat on that body. And there was some discussion in the EIM governance context that really tried to look at the public power's role in this when they're not jurisdictional to their state regulators. And that this body would have primary authority over certain specific policies, initiatives that would be further defined by the transitional committee. And again, we use the SPP and MISO models as an example, and the discussion amongst Western states was that they really thought that some of these components were very important to have regional regulators voice in, primarily the transmission cost allocation and aspects of regional resource adequacy. To the extent that they are of common interest amongst the Western states. And I think the details of that need to be determined, and we look forward to stakeholder comment on that. And the idea of how these states would make decisions was also discussed. And I think in Ron Binns's paper, as well as Commissioner Mike Florio's paper, the idea of a voting rule that is similar to a voting rule for YRAB, and I always forget what that acronym spells out, but it's a Western sort of energy reliability board that serves to be an advisory committee to the Western Electric Coordinating Council. They have a voting structure that we're using here, suggesting here, that a positive vote would require a majority of the members of the body, as well as members representing at least the majority of the load in the footprint. So it's sort of a dual voting system that ensures that no one state would have total control, and that there would be an acknowledgement that there is these states have varying sizes in terms of their load. To go on with the body of regulators, we think that on matters where this body had primary authority, the regional ISO would need to obtain approval before they would make a filing at FERC. And it may only file the body's approved proposal. So it's really meant to say that the state regulators would have a significant voice in shaping policies on those specific items that I mentioned before it could go be filed with FERC. There are exceptions that we need to note, that if there are things either in an emergency capacity or in a way that could affect reliability, we take action, the ISO would need to take action quickly. And if there were an event where the supermajority of the ISO board thought that a proposal from the state regulators proposed something that could undermine reliability, that both proposals could be put forward. There are a lot of details to work out on this, but it's something that the state regulators have had a lot of discussions on. And again, we look forward to your thoughts and comments on that. So we also acknowledge that there might be other components of our current governance structure that may need to be reviewed. We suggested a few here. The transitional committee could consider these items as they're looking at governance in more detail. They include really any process improvements that the new ISO would undertake that could facilitate the broader participation that it will see. And it could include the development of a formal stakeholder committee that has been suggested in many of the papers that we saw. And it could also look at the creation of any kind of funding mechanism to support consumer advocates it was a comment that we also heard. I would note that many stakeholders in their comments supported the current ISO process, but again, once we get into a larger regional picture, we know that those things might need to be revisited. So those are the elements of the proposal. Certainly, we look forward to hearing from the panel today and the comments that we'll receive here today in public comment or written comment. I wanted to just note these are some upcoming dates that might be of importance in this process. Several of them are just targets. We don't have any definite times on these, but we wanted to at least kind of spell out the next steps in our minds. Obviously, we'll present this here today and as well in Denver on Monday. We're asking for comments by July 7th through the CEC docket process. And then the ISO would take those comments that we heard and revise a proposal tentatively to post around July 19th. And this is in anticipation of the joint agency workshop that I mentioned earlier, which essentially helps kind of comply with the steps laid out in SB 350, where both governance modifications and the study results from our work with our consultants together and be presented in front of the CEC, CPUC, and the Air Resources Board. And then, as the bill states, we would submit this to the governor, and then they could submit it onto the legislature. We have an email for anything related to regional integration, and that's here at the bottom of the page. We encourage folks at any point along the way, if they have questions, they can always ask us through that venue and submit comments through the CEC docket. I posted here just a few reference items that folks can go to all on the web, the California Energy Docket, as well as the Senate Bill 350. That has all the detail language and just some facts off of our ISO website. And our ISO website does have a variety of information about all of our stakeholder processes and any meetings that we have regarding this subject. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Stacy. So from the dais, any questions for Stacy first, and then Leanne and Michael. I'm fine.
We're going to have Angelina comment.
Angelina,
okay.
Comment.
So I have a couple of questions. Stacy, right. Do you go back up just a couple of slides? Keep that slide. Could you the second exception? There's some more discussion in the proposal about process that would precede a step like that. I'm wondering if you could articulate what that would be. That there's an attempt to resolve this through the body of state regulators before the ISO board would go ahead and submit a complementary or a companion proposal.
Yes, thank you, Cliff. The idea is that we really give the body of regulators full opportunity to come to a decision. I think, one, there might be disagreement within the committee itself, but then there might be disagreement between the committee and the ISO itself. But I think we want to offer somehow in the bylaws and makeup of this body the real opportunity to resolve those conflicts in a way that allows them some time. So I think we note these here. Those are sort of more extreme cases, but we know that in practice we want to reach consensus. I think that's the common goal. We've heard from SPP and MISO that, in fact, they've really never had a disagreement between their regional state committees and the ISO in terms of submitting things, but the opportunity is there, and we want to have a mechanism to allow some sort of, I wouldn't call it mediation, but sort of conflict resolution period. And I'm not recalling if we were specific there or not, but that was the intent.
Okay, then the second question is the proposal doesn't speak to the role that states might have in nominating board members once there's a permanent board in place. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about what role the states might have on a permanent basis going forward in nominating board members on a nominating committee or whatever.
Yeah, certainly. I think there's a few ways to do that. We certainly looked at the variety of ways that other ISOs do this and other sort of regional boards. You could have a sector stakeholder group, such as we do now with our board nominating process and that the EIM governing body process has, where you have sectors look at a pool of candidates, sort of narrow it down, and then propose a slate. That slate could be reviewed and approved by some state representatives. So that's one way of looking at it, whether they're appointed or somehow they could either be appointed by the state governor or they could be the body of regulators. There's a couple of ways you could do that. But certainly there could be a significant role for the states in approving either a slate or helping select the slate of candidates for this board. I think it's really something that we hope to seek feedback on, but we think that the states could have an approval role in this process.
I have a question on the same topic. The sort of the backstop for reliability issues. Do you anticipate that the transitional committee would, as part of its process, further define what sort of the standard is for when reliability would be determined to be imminently threatened, or would that be more of a case by case determination that the CAISO the new ISO would make in coordination with the state regulators as part of kind of that dispute resolution process you were just talking about?
Well, I might look to our legal team to address this, but in terms of sort of the reliability component, we have obligations under NERC, the North American Energy Reliability Corporation, our organization, and other operational duties. So I don't know those specifics, but I think that there might be some things that through FERC and rulings that they've made on previous issues like this might have more to say about this. But we would certainly want to work with the transitional committee to look at those details and really where the scope could be discussed or where it's somewhat sort of set by FERC or NERC compliance standards. I'm not sure if I addressed that.
I asked if your attorneys want to make any comments at this time. Or?
Hello, I'm Burke Gross. I'm an assistant general counsel at the ISO. I would just point out that I think there are definitely some reliability standards that NERC promulgates, and if we were to be in a position where we are imminently about to violate some sort of a standard of that type, that would be one situation where we would be potentially in that exception. It might not necessarily be the only situation. There could be other situations where reliability is threatened, but a reliability standard is not actually directly at place. And so those are issues that would need to be developed in more detail at some point, and quite possibly in the context of the transitional committee.
Okay, thanks.
So in the proposed draft, there's on page 2 under preservation of state authority a statement that this will include a provision that prohibits the ISO from proposing or endorsing any centralized market for forward procurement of electric capacity projects. So I'm just curious as to whether you believe that the record elsewhere has bookmarked what's included and what's not included, or whether that's something that will be left to establishment of bylaws and the process that evolves through establishing governance. I'm concerned that we not inadvertently preclude procurement of ancillary products and forward commitments of ancillary products like ramping or load following or other important qualities that relate to reliability.
Thank you, President Picker. I'm going to have Keith Casey address that with the ISO.
Yeah, thank you. Keith Casey, California ISO. Our intent in this language is really to cover the kind of the year-ahead, multi-year-ahead centralized capacity market that you have in the Eastern ISOs. Frankly, there's probably an opportunity to further clarify that language, and maybe that is something the transitional committee could help make clear, because we really wanted to limit it to that kind of longer term procurement through some sort of a centralized auction type process. Okay. And just for my edification, page 4, composition of the regional ISO board, third bullet references the regional board, all of whom must meet FERC requirements for financial independence. Could somebody just quickly sketch those out for me, since I'm not always familiar with them?
Sure.
I have a sense how we define independence here for California's definition. Is it fairly similar? Are there other features that I'm not acquainted with?
Yeah, I'll have Dan Schonkweiler respond to that from the ISO.
Yeah, hi, I'm Dan Schonkweiler, an in-house attorney from the ISO. FERC's financial requirements for independent directors are they're spelled out in their regulations, but essentially they prohibit an independent director from having a financial interest in a market participant in that market. And so the way we implement that currently at the ISO is we have a list of publicly traded companies and private companies that our investors and our employees can't invest in. But generally, yes, the requirements are similar to, you know, generally similar to the requirements that apply elsewhere.
And how do you screen for that in the selection process?
I can give you an example from the recent selection process for the EIM governing board that Governor Golitova mentioned. Generally, the search firm and the nominating committee identify candidates, they explain those requirements, and when the candidates aren't clear whether they can satisfy those requirements, they share that information gets shared with ISO Legal, and we help them apply the criteria and tell them whether or not they can satisfy the requirements. And a part of that is, in some cases, a decision that a candidate's willing to divest of an investment or an affiliation that they have before they proceeded if they were chosen.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I was just going to ask one question, which again is probably maybe a little bit too, anyway, next level down. But when we're talking about the relationship between the body of state regulators and the ISO board with Commissioner Florio the last time, the question I asked him was, if there could be a mechanism, you know, where if the regulators could not agree by a given time with some degree of latitude that, you know, if it's by a certain board meeting that, you know, they'd have a carryover to the next one. But if they could not agree at some point, the ISO board would just have to move forward. I notice that's not in here, I guess, just to understand the logic a little bit.
Yes, I think there's certainly a need to keep certain policies moving forward, especially if they impact market participants in a way, you know, that negatively impacts them in some way. So I think there would need to be some provision about a time frame in which a stalemate or some sort of indecision could be made. I think, again, you could call it conflict resolution or mediation, but something that got them to a decision, or at a certain point, something would trigger just the ISO coming to a decision for them.
Yeah, I think Commissioner Florio, our assumption is by having that sort of mechanism, you force the regulators to argue through their differences and come to a decision. Yeah. And again, you obviously have some latitude on time to give them a little more time to bake it out. But anyway,
we never have a hard time making a decision. It would just take several years to do it.
You're now going to be the new ISO board.
All right. Okay. So, Jamina, you want to say a few words?
I'm just going to say a few words. I made most of my comments at the beginning. The ISO board is very involved in the process and keeps a close eye and has an oversight on what's happening. I just want to point out that Governor Mike Sarin is on the line and available as well, and that in Denver we're going to have Governor Ash Bagwat in person in the capacity that I'm in over here. So we want to make sure that we preserve California's authority and ensure that our energy, climate efficiency, and greenhouse goals remain intact and front and center. As a matter of fact, we want this process to help facilitate the transition to more electric vehicle transportation, as well as switching and transitioning to more renewable fuels. So this is a process that we want to make sure facilitates the greenhouse gas objectives that our state has outlined and has so prominently supported at the COP, at the SEM, and with the under two MOU. I also would like to point out the fact that we do have 38 balancing authorities in the West. It is a big void. There have been overtures made by other ISOs to come into this market and consolidate balancing authorities. It's a logical, efficient step to take, as was pointed out by Secretary John Kerry, NEF, who said this is a void that's got to be filled. Who's going to step up to the challenge? Is it going to be California or somebody else? So it's an opportunity for us to take a leadership role, to build bridges with our neighbors, and to make sure that we have the best solutions, because as the California ISO, we've invested a lot of effort into having this phenomenal IT solution, and we want to make sure that it benefits our neighbors as well. And of course, environmental justice issues, environmental goals, jobs, economic development in California, and what the studies show is also going to be a positive economic impact to our economy, actually does happen and will work. All of us on the board, together with the stakeholders, if anything, compared to the EM, we will have an oversight role over there too, and make sure that we keep a close eye on the process and do our best to achieve the objectives as outlined.
Great, thank you. So, I think at this, let's transition to the roundtable discussion. Almost on.
If the panelists can come up to the podiums, we'll turn the name tags around so you can see where you're sitting.
Thanks. All right. I assume the housekeeping's done.
Yeah, I was going to say, certainly. Good afternoon, Governor, Mayor Foster. Thanks for agreeing to serve as moderator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's hard to have my name associated with moderation, but what the hell. I'm Bob Foster. I'm a former, well, a lot of former things, but former chair of the Independent System Operator, and I'm going to moderate this panel today. I've talked to most of the panelists, directly or indirectly, about this presentation. The goal here today is to try to have each and every one of you in your presentations touch on at least, even lightly, at least all of the 8 points that are raised in the principles. So I'd urge you to do that. I do know from comments that I've received from panelists that a particular import is the state body and its relationship to the future board, the independence of that future board and what that means. Those seem to be areas where a lot of issues have been raised. So I think almost everyone is on this panel has some comments along those lines. But during your presentation, I would urge you to try to touch on all 8 points. We have what some would call a distinguished panel. It is Dee Dee Hapner, who is the Vice President for FERC and ISO Relations at Pacific Gas and Electric, Tony Braun, President of Braun, Blazing, McLaughlin, and Smith, Allison Clemens, the Director of Sustainable FERC Project for the Natural Resources Defense Council, Matt Friedman, who's a staff attorney with the Utility Reform Network, Mark Joseph, who's with Adams, Broadwell, Joseph, and Cardoza, Rachel Gold is the Policy Director of Large Scale Solar Association, Sakita, I hope I pronounced that right, Grant, with the Greenlining Institute, and Mark Smith, who's the Vice President of Government Relations for Calpine. We'll start in that order, if you don't mind. We'll go with Ms. Hapner.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to be a panelist again on these very important topics. I will briefly touch on all of these at Mr. Foster's request, but I am most prepared to talk about some more than others, and I suspect from our call as a group that other panels will be somewhat similarly situated. I do come to this panel and this effort with a long history with the formation of the ISO and having been on the Board of Governors of the ISO prior to the change that required gubernatorial appointments and a much smaller board and Senate confirmation. So I'm very invested, both personally and on behalf of PG&E, in the success of the ISO and our commitment in California to a clean energy future that will likely go well beyond the 50% current RPS. With respect to going through the topics that were covered very ably by Stacy Crawley, the preservation of state authority, I think, is a foundational principle that the ISO currently adheres to and should be the basis for an expanded regional ISO. As Stacy mentioned, we have this codified in our bylaws and tariffs that have been filed with FERC, as well as some elements that were in the legislation and continue to be in the requirements in SB 350. So I think this is absolutely the price of entry for not just California, but for the other states that are contemplating this kind of move. I would note in this section and other sections, we refer very often to the bylaws and changes in the bylaws. And we can have a streamlined set of bylaws, which I think is what we have right now. But in terms of any changes that we might make or expectations we might have, those would come in the form of tariff amendments that would be approved by the Federal Regulatory Commission, which is the jurisdictional entity for the high voltage transmission system. So I'm not going to dwell on that section. I think it's the right way to go. Greenhouse gas accounting, I think this has been an issue that came up clearly in our EIM discussions, and we resolved it. Whether that is enough for an expanded discussion in these areas, I think that remains to be seen. There is a stakeholder process that has not yet begun on just this issue, and I expect that will add significantly to this discussion and the commitments that were made and expectations that Governor Calatiba mentioned earlier. Transmission owner withdrawal, as Stacy said, there is a current provision for withdrawing from the ISO with 2 years' notice. I think that an option for withdrawal makes sense. I think we need to think about both some costs that may or may not go along with that. We're in a different time than we were when the ISO went live in 1998. And criteria, this should not be something that any state or utility takes on lightly. Transitional committee, I'm very supportive of a transitional committee. This may be because I thought that as a transitional committee for EIM, we worked very successfully. We were all nominated by our sectors, but everyone in the room knew that we had to operate as one team, and we did. And I think that that is a good model for going forward. I do think, though, transition and implementation need to be thought out because this is a fast pace, and one of the concerns that I think many of us have had with the ISO process is it's a very fast pace. So if we're going to put any weight into this kind of effort, which would be a much broader effort than even the EIM was, I suspect, we have to make sure that we provide enough time for the board to do its job and for stakeholders to have many bites at the apple in terms of their input. The initial board and transition period, this is a process that we thought about in great detail for the EIM governing body. I think it makes a lot of sense that there be some kind of transition. I guess my one caveat on that is that I think it's important for California and the other states to get to the new reality as soon as possible. So I think to facilitate that in such a way that we move quickly beyond political appointments and have a genuine stakeholder process with an overall board of governors that represent the region, so much the better. We have a lot to do as a region and a lot to work out, and so some timing, some orchestration, and a little more meat on the bones, I think, in this area would be helpful. I'm trying to speed talk here. With respect to the composition of the ISO board, same kind of comments. I don't know where nomination versus approval cross over, and I'd like to hear the input of the other panelists as well as stakeholders that will want and need to weigh in on this. It may be very difficult to move beyond a temporary board where people get comfortable in their roles. So again, I think the composition should be as regional as possible, as soon as possible. And there were many models that were discussed in our last panel that have various checks and balances for size, load, et cetera. And I think they're all great places to start the discussion. With respect to the body of state regulators, this is one where the work, I think, really needs to be at the principal level to get buy-in. And I think it's important to think about how what are the most important activities for this board and which activities are already in the context of other ISOs and RTOs and will be acceptable in tariff filings at FERC. So a couple of areas just give me pause at this stage. I know we are at the principal level, but I'm a little bit concerned about the elements of transmission planning and allocation that may be an overpromise on the part of this proposal. I think we really need to look carefully into that. I would not want to see an ISO that just runs the system and doesn't have a planning process. And a transmission cost allocation, as controversial as that is, and it's extremely controversial in my company at the moment. So I just think we need to really think this through, think about what works, and again, would be acceptable to FERC. My understanding of the body of state regulators, and I think we all need to do a lot more homework on this, is that while FPP and MISO have 205 rights, the ability to file, that they don't trump their ISO RTO's ability to make a proposal. They can have competing proposals, but the body of state regulators doesn't file in lieu of the RTO or ISO. I could be mistaken, but I think that's a distinction with a difference. So I'd like to really know more about that. And then establishment of the body of state regulators, I think that's the purview of the regulators, and I think, again, it's something that exists in all other RTOs, and the regulators are best positioned to determine how that would play out in the real world. Lastly, with respect to the stakeholder process, I think we have a very effective stakeholder process, which is already on steroids. So any more steroids, and I think it may collapse under its own weight. But I think discussion around this and what it could look like and what it should look like going forward will just add to the discussion.
Thank you. Feel free, panelists, to comment. If you hear something from another panel member, feel free to comment on it or raise an issue that they raised. Ms. Hapner has, I think, centered a lot of her comments on the State Board of Regulators, or the Board of State Regulators, and that's something Mr. Joseph commented on, too, and some of the comments I saw from you that the state issues were paramount, so I'm going to turn to you, Mark Joseph.
Thanks, Bob. I'm going to start with history because I think it's important and instructive. In 1998, we had the power exchange, and all the energy in California was bought and sold through the power exchange. No one at the time foresaw that 4 years later, the power exchange would be bankrupt, defunct, and that we needed a complete, utter policy change. In 2000, I'm not sure anybody had ever uttered the words resource adequacy or local RA. Those words were just never spoken, and yet a few years later, we have a whole apparatus to quantify it, to set the requirements, to go out and buy it. We needed a policy change. In 2000, utilities were forbidden from signing long-term contracts. 4 years later, it was mandatory. We needed a policy change. In 2010, before SB2, PV was the most expensive renewable generating technology. No one knew that 5 years later it was going to become the least expensive, and that change has brought the need for lots of policy changes. In 2010, the IOUs were buying every renewable project proposed that had a heartbeat, and a lot of them that didn't have heartbeats, because they were deathly afraid of not complying with the requirements. Price was basically irrelevant. Who knew that only a few years later we'd have a situation where 90% plus of the proposals to the utilities for power purchase agreements would be rejected, and it would be accepting only a tiny fraction of the proposals because we'd have so many and so many choices, and the competition was so fierce that a fraction of a penny per kilowatt hour would separate winners from losers. In SB2, as that law was developed, we spent an enormous amount of time working out language for dealing with load-serving entities failing to comply with their RPS obligations, because we thought 33% by 2020 was so risky and so difficult. Well, it turned out to be so wrong that the Commission has never even bothered to finalize its rules on noncompliance because it's completely, utterly unnecessary. It's a total policy change. SDG&E just announced, you know, they're at 35% in 2015. For decades, we've had peak demand in the middle of the afternoon on sunny days. We've had time of use prices to discourage usage then. Who predicted that now we'd have overgeneration, negative pricing, and time of use rates to encourage usage in the middle of the afternoon on sunny days? We need policy changes. The point here is not to say that we're really terrible at predicting the future, though one could say the evidence would lead to that conclusion. The point is the only thing we can really be certain of is that we're going to need fundamental policy changes over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and we don't know what they are. Fundamental policy changes should be reserved for the province of states answering to their political constituents. they shouldn't be made by a board of technocrats who are not answerable to the body politic. Now, this is true both for California policies and for policies of the other states. Any state whose utilities will be joining this, I think, has the same interest, that they want to have some control over what the policy changes are going to be in the future. Now, the proposal that's been laid out here identifies a couple of the hot topics. We know capacity markets are a hot topic, and we want to reserve that for the Board of State Regulators. We know that transmission cost allocation is a hot topic. But there are plenty of other hot topics that we don't know about yet, and we can't possibly enumerate them and anticipate now what they're going to be. Yet they should be decided by the entity that is responsible to the political apparatus of each of the states whose constituents are involved here. So where does that lead me? I think it leads to a simple conclusion, and that is that what we're calling the Board of State Regulators should be the board of the new ISO. Those are the entities that should be supreme. It should not be a board of technocrats or experts. The body of state regulators, the board, should certainly have at its disposal experts who can advise it. But the only way to ensure that future policy changes, which we know will have to take place, will be made by people who will answer to those who are, you know, supposedly in charge of our political system, is to have that body be the supreme body. It also has the benefit of making this whole thing a lot simpler. We don't have to worry about who's got Section 205 rights and who doesn't, what about competings, and what if it's a deadlock. The whole proposal gets a whole lot simpler if we have a board from each of the states. I would say each of the states should decide on its own how it wants to pick its representative, use the same voting model that's proposed here for the body of state regulators, you know, House and Senate voting, majority of states, majority of load, and have that be the entity. And they don't have to be regulators, you know. We don't have to ask you to take two jobs. They should simply be chosen by the state.
Speaking of the mic.
They should be people who are...
My mind is spinning. Nice tan, by the way.
It was sunny on Sunday.
You're saying that the state regulator should be the Board of State Regulators, which should be the Board of Governors, but they aren't necessarily the board that it would be selected for this. Does that mean that then this new board would have primacy over the CPUC?
No.
Or does it mean that I get to regulate the public utilities?
What I mean is that the individuals who are on the board, which I think should be the political board with the kind of voting that's described for the Board of State Regulators, the individuals should be chosen by the states. They could be a state regulator. They don't have to be a state regulator. You can have people whose full-time job is just to be on the ISO board. If a state wants to pick somebody who is the president of the PUC to be on that board, that's okay too. But it's up to the state. I'm still...
Okay, but let me ask a different question. In your history, you went through a series of events, most of which seem to be characterizable as power procurement. Is that fair or unfair?
They were mostly in those topic areas, but you know, I think the demise of the power exchange, I think, is a good example of how the whole theory might be wrong.
I'm just suggesting that, you know, obviously transmission is a hot issue. Obviously procurement or resource planning is a traditional state role. But I'm not quite sure out of those broad categories, and again, I've certainly spent my life doing forecasts, some of which have been wrong, you know, that there are these huge other things that suddenly should be reserved to the states. But again, certainly think about that. You know, I know you're going to do written comments, so, you know, after all this is done.
I think that the point is that issues come up which require policy decisions. And we need to ensure that the entity that's making those policy decisions, to the extent they're not things reserved for the states, successfully reserved for the states, should be made by a board which is a political board, which is responsible to the states, not responsible to nobody. That's the point that I'm trying to make here, that, you know, right now we have an ISO board that has five appointees of the governor. You know, the future board should be politically responsive to the various states. I think all states certainly have the uniform desire that no state be able to trample the policies of another state. Utah has the same concern that California does. And the voting method is the technique to avoid trampling. But making the body of state regulators subservient in any way to, you know, what Stacey's calling the ISO. That's the whole thought process, is somehow it's subservient to. I think it's a mistake. I think we need to keep control over policies, including policies which we can't anticipate will arise. So, you know, the pushback, when I raised this before, I get two kinds of pushback. One is, oh, well, those people have to be independent. Yes, that's true. They have to be financially independent as individuals. No question about that. But that's, you know, that's a prerequisite anyway. The second is, well, will FERC approve it? Well, I look at the current ISO board. They're straight out appointees of the governor of California. FERC approved it. So I don't see any a priori reason why a board that looks like what we're calling the Board of State Regulators, but actually is the ISO board, would be unacceptable to FERC. And I think it would give, you know, we've heard this concern expressed a lot, you know, why are the other states going to buy in? How are the other states, how are we going to get them to want to do this too? I think it would be reassuring to them to know that the ultimate decision makers are people they have some control over.
Let me encourage you to go back to the 8 points or whatever.
I think if you do this one thing, most of the rest of the stuff that's in here is within the ballpark. I don't have big disagreements with anything except for the supremacy, which board is supreme.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Joseph. I just want to add a couple of things. First of all, I lived through that same history that you went down memory lane. Some of it I might take some exception with, but I might want to point out that I do want to point out that some of those procurement decisions were actually made, for example, were made by regulatory or political bodies. For example, the prohibition on long-term contracting was clearly a political decision and a regulatory decision. So I know you're not saying they're omniscient, but they clearly are not omniscient. And secondly, in your written comments, if you could draw the distinction between technocrat and competent scientist, I would like to see that as well. And you're obviously a fan of the Brits exiting the union, but that's all right. For much the same reason, I might add.
I'm not sure about that one.
If you don't like technocrats, you will not like the EU. I can guarantee you that. Anyway, thank you. That was thought-provoking. And so on all the other seven things, you're okay, but on this one you have a...
Yeah, I mean, this really comes up in, you know, three or four of these topics, and it doesn't fit neatly into one box.
Okay, I appreciate that. I'm glad I called on you. Thanks. We'll now go to Tony Braun. And Tony, who are you representing today? I'm just curious.
I got that same question from the Chair Wiesenmiller at the May 6th, so I was going to delve into that pretty much immediately. So thank you. As part of this process, we've had a broad coalition of public power entities from across the West that have spent quite a lot of time in trying to put together a set of recommendations with respect to what any regional governance proposal would look like. And we circulated that, included them. I think everyone probably has seen them by now. It's not a secret that, across Western Interconnection, you're going to probably get quite a diversity of views when it comes to the efficacy of a regional RTO. If you go up into the Northwest, there's public power entities up there with 100% carbon-free 2.5-cent retail power, all in. and they're nervous about any change because they like it quite the way it is. If you go to the eastern part of the Western Interconnection, you'll find 100% coal-reliant entities that are concerned, as probably we've seen from some of the communications from the states in that area, that that we're going to be exporting California's carbon carbon footprint. And then closer to home, we have the Imperial Irrigation District that is in active litigation against the ISO, and based on some public discussions, doesn't want to see any expansion or of the current structure. And yet, certainly, if this is going to move forward, we're looking for certain key things as a public power community, and that's what I'd like to communicate today. First of all, we're looking for a comprehensive package. And we've communicated this quite a bit, whether it's TAC or RA, and this is sort of bringing it all together. For those that aren't spending a lot of time on some of the technical issues that technocrats are trying to wrestle with, both the transmission access charge proposal and the resource adequacy proposal both point to this proposal. So we've created an infinite loop where the resolution of key policy issues is dependent on the resolution of governance. And that's why we've always argued that this should go first. And so that's our primary message today. We want to get this right. We want to get this comprehensive package put together. There's a proposal here for an advisory role on the body of state regulators for public power. What we think of that depends on some of the other aspects of this, including the structure of the board, including the robustness of the stakeholder process. So it's everything is meshed together, and all of our comments on individual items are reflecting the need to look at this in a holistic way. So once again, we'll say we need to take the time to get this right. There's no reason why we can't come to grips with a comprehensive governance package, do it in a timely fashion. We have a lot of examples of things that work in one way, shape, or form. We can take a look at what may fit and what may not fit for a Western experience, and then take the best points of those items and come up with something that works. What we would not like to see are actions on the TAC, actions on RA, or statutory changes before we see a comprehensive governance proposal. That's been our ask all along.
Tony, when you say statutory changes, do you mean exclusive other than the governance proposal? What statutory changes are you referring to?
Any statutory changes.
But with respect to what
changes? Changes in California law that would enable governance changes to move forward. What we would like to see.
You want the bylaws written before the legislature enables a new governance structure.
Correct. So let me, Mayor Foster, let me go through some of the specific elements since we were asking Mark to do that. Stakeholder process. So as an example, we'd like to have a little more detail. You know, we don't need to know the number of committees. We don't need to know what their titles are or how many times they meet or what kind of support they're going to get from ISO staff. But we would like to know that there is going to be a market advisory committee, that it is going to be made up of sector representatives at an executive level, and that they will have direct interface with the board, however it's constituted, as part of a robust stakeholder process. We do not want to see, as we've alluded to in the past, and there's a concern and a legitimate concern, that we end up with 40 committees and this incredibly burdensome process. We do not want to replicate that. But we do think that when we see other boards of other RTOs meeting in conjunction with the Market Advisory Committee and policy proposals are presented jointly to the Market Advisory Committee and the Decisional Board, even though that Market Advisory Committee only has an advisory role, we think that has a very beneficial effect of bringing the sectors together with the decision makers and trying to get past some of the market issues that come up on a regular basis. Public power in the body of state regulators. As I alluded to, we've always urged that there be a role, but we haven't specified exactly how that would be. And that's because, well, probably for a couple of reasons, there's likely diversity across the public power footprint in the Western United States about whether it needs to be a voting role or whether it needs to be an advisory role. There are approximately 8 million customers of public power in the Western United States. There's 5 million customers of public power in the California and PAC footprint alone. That is well over 20% of the customers served within the proposed footprint that's before us. They are not represented by the state regulators. They do not have rate-making jurisdiction over these public power entities. And in oftentimes, there's just a completely different perspective. And so with that significant percentage of consumers being served by public power in the West, they need to have a direct role on the body of state regulators. How that is fashioned depends, I think, on the whole structure in its entirety. Withdrawal rights. Let's not get too wedded to the fact that withdrawal rights are going to be some sort of salve. The transmission control agreement says, and I think I'm going to get this right, that a PTO may withdraw upon 2 years' notice upon all applicable regulatory approvals. And that generic language was there because no one could agree on what the applicable regulatory approvals were. Some argue that actually FERC can countermand state directions for a PTO to withdraw from an RTO-like structure. There is a lot of open issues as to what are really effective withdrawal rights, and certainly the commercial disruption can be significant. When you have market participants that are entered into PPAs and then they've taken CRR positions, and they have maybe had other hedging type of financial instruments to back their portfolio. The balancing authorities and the PTOs have joint registration agreements where they walk through all the various NERC criteria and they parse out who's responsible for what. Taking apart an RTO structure and pulling a significant PTO out of that structure is a significant, complex, and thorny task, and it shouldn't be taken lightly. So I don't think we should, for the purposes of government, let's not count on that as being some sort of solution to a problem that might arise. Transitional committee. We care more about what the comprehensive governance proposal is than how we develop it. Certainly, my experience on the transitional committee, like Aditi's, is it was extraordinarily rewarding. It worked extremely well. I think the work product was excellent. But what we would like to see is perhaps a little more direction if we're going to have a transitional committee. For example, this utter lack of specificity on the stakeholder process is something we would want to augment. And we'll be providing specific written comments to detail what we would like to see in that. We know this is a starting point. On the hybrid transition, our public power proposal did not have that. We always anticipated what was phrased to me this morning, a hot cutover to an independent board. I think we would like to consider all alternatives in that. It's something certainly that would be on the table. I don't know if we've wrestled with the pros and cons. And then state authority. We very strongly support the preservation of state authority. If someone could tell me what that means specifically, I've heard Commissioner Savage, for example, say that siting authority and approvals for transmission need to be preserved. Absolutely. I don't think anything an RTO can do will take that away. It could greatly affect it. But we've seen the PUC, CPCN processes not approve lines that have been approved through the ISO's TPP. Or we've seen proposed downsizing. We won't go any farther and get into any open dockets. The RA, well, that planning reserve margins are set by local regulatory authorities, but the must-offer obligations are set by the ISO. The local, set by the ISO. The flexible are set by the ISO. So let's be also be realistic about the interface. It's a complex interface. We strongly support preserving as much state and local authority as possible, but the operation of the wholesale market will affect state policy. And I think we all understand that. It's good to have specific examples. So those are the sort of the high points of where we have been, our reaction to the initial proposal that the ISO put out. It would be absolutely filing written comments, and if there's more specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Braun. So just a couple of comments from my perspective. I don't think anyone's going to argue with that we should get it right, whatever it is. Comprehensive proposal for governance should be done right, but what I think I read in your comments and your testimony is you think that doing it right would be consistent with doing it this year.
Yeah, that's
just
a good synopsis.
I want to make that clear. So how much time should we take?
I think we could have governance done this year.
When?
We could have governance done this year, and the other processes, whether it be carbon, TAC, RA, or GMC, cannot happen in parallel. TAC has sort of gone into a holding pattern where we're sort of pointing to the future deliberations. Our concern has been we're locking in part of the equation. I mean, you've got the how do you pay for existing facilities, how do you pay for new. We're locking in how do you pay for existing, and we have an open question on how do you pay for new. That leaves me kind of between a rock and a hard place and trying to find a consensus risk. So we don't want to see FERC filings. We don't want to see things locked down until we know how this is going to work. So I think we can still go in parallel. We have to get going on carbon, and so we can still move forward. But I would hate to see us chart a fairly irreversible course.
Okay. Thank you. Michael?
Real quickly, given that I've always been impressed by the kind words and the praise that you heaped on the transitional process for establishing the EIM governance and
very self-serving,
right? But many of the questions that they face in terms of governance and the establishment of bylaws still are kind of hazy. So I'm a little surprised to see you taking a different perspective here. But I also want to reflect a lot on the diversity of the public power community. While I understand your specific clients here have one position, I did get a presentation from some of the Northwestern public power entities where they seem to be arguing for a position on the Board of State Regulators as a means of actually ensuring that they participate. And that's reflected here in the proposed documents before us. So I wonder if you would care to speak to that. Do your public power clients differ from the Northwest folks who seem to be advocating for that, or is this just something that you want to see pinned down and bylaws first, action later?
So the public power community that worked on the paper that covered a lot of governance principles included most of the California entities, Southwest, Rocky Mountain, and quite a bit Northwest entities. And we were purposefully we advocated strongly for a role for public power for the reasons I argued that just a lot of customers served by public power. And so we will definitely be arguing that there needs to be a role. We have not really coalesced or even begun sort of a concrete discussion on will we insist on a voting role. So that's an open deliberation. It could be that some of the Northwest entities would die on their sword with respect to whether it's a voting role or not. But I think there's some pros and cons, and it is tied to the Market Advisory Committee. So. How those two things dovetail, is the core principle what we're looking for.
So at this point, you don't speak to the specific notion here of actually being represented on the Board of State Regulators?
So we absolutely want to be represented on the Board of State Regulators. I think it's more into the next level of mechanics. Is it going to be an advisory role? How many? I think you'd come up with a higher number than one if you looked at a load ratio share of the affected states. And whether or not it's purely an advisory role and whom. We've expressed some concerns about the efficacy of having, say, you know, a city council person serving that's not, doesn't have a whole depth of background on electricity matters. So it's really not a question of whether, but how.
I would note, I mean, Tony was a valuable member of the transitional committee. The one issue we really struggled with on the public power side is, you know, in terms of that representation, do we say that it has to be from their rate-making body, or is it, you know, they're basically their general manager who may or may not be participating in the power markets? And, you know, frankly, he's nodding, go ahead, most of us were, no, we didn't want that participant, you know, in the power markets. We wanted someone more equivalent to you or I, you know, on the regulatory side representing public power. But, again, it's a very diverse. I would also note that I think on Monday we'll probably hear from Bonneville some of their impressions on these issues.
I mean, it's complicated. I mean, there are some existing public power entities that are dispatched by the ISO, whereas many of the others remain their own balancing authority and do their own dispatch. So, but generally they have avoided participation in these kinds of comprehensive regulated entities and that are FERC jurisdictional. So I'm struggling to figure how and where people think that they fit into this kind of.
In the earlier workshop, I made Tony go through the issue of basically the legal question of does participation affect whether or not you're regulated by FERC or POU, and why, you know, basically SMUD was in the ISO, you know, and again Tony was if you could summarize again, at least for Michael's benefit, on this question.
I mean, FERC jurisdiction has so many different elements to it, right? So it's hard. It's important not to forget some of them. Everyone is subject to reliability standards. You could have a municipal utility that owns transmission, but that does not transfer control of its transmission facilities to the ISO, even though they're in the ISO. So there are some of those. So the issue of whether FERC has rate-making authority over their transmission is clear as it's ever been, which is the answer is no. And yet, once you transfer operational control of your transmission to the ISO and the cost of it get in the overall TAC, it's a different answer. Everyone that's in the ISO has to comply with the tariff. It's part and parcel of yet. There's nothing that has changed on the log with respect to whether or not FERC can order refunds. So it's a pretty nuanced with many, many different answers depending on what the specific question is.
Yeah, no, thanks. I just want to make sure people knew it was nuanced. It wasn't just black and white. You go in, you're there. If you don't go in, you're not, you know, except for maybe Texas. Anyway.
Okay. Thank you, Tony. Turn to Allison Clements in the NRDC.
Thanks. I'm Allison Clements. I am the director of the Sustainable FERC Project at Natural Resources Defense Council. We appreciate the opportunity to present our perspective. Our coalition is a group of national environmental organizations that has historically, for the last two decades, been focused on removing federal regulatory barriers to clean energy deployment, accelerated renewables deployment, and clean demand-side resources deployment, which means we spend a lot of time at FERC, and we spend a lot of time participating in market design and transmission planning processes in the Eastern Interconnection RTOs. I've relocated to Salt Lake City and have worked with my colleagues in our Western office to think through some of the issues related to the potential development of a Western regional grid operator. With that background, I really commend the ISO's draft set of principles in terms of both listening to stakeholder input and also incorporating best practices that we've identified from other regions of the country in several cases. My general caveats before I get to the specific items are that when I speak about RTOs, it's really important for me to say that they are not an end unto themselves. This is not the end goal to develop a great big RTO. But as someone who spent the better part of the last two decades working to reduce carbon emissions and to ensure affordable energy as part of that, and to think about localized health impacts of power generation, I don't see another way to get there without taking this step. And I mean by that the entire step, the whole market, the complement of markets that comes with a regional RTO, as well as the transmission planning pieces, and thinking through the EIM, which has shown great benefits and potential. I don't think that goes far enough to get to that place. If you look at the countless national lab studies on how we get to the penetration of renewables, we need to get to our 2050 goals. It supports my perspective. So all of the comments I make are with the recognition that we have to that the end is not perfect, and we have to work hard to make it work well. One of the things I think that threatens some of the benefits, the benefits are there. I think when we think about what is in it for the states, what is in it for California and the states that haven't joined the RTO, there's a tremendous number of financial benefits to be accrued. There's carbon emission and other pollution reduction to be accrued. We've seen that in the initial studies. Money's going to get spent on grid modernization in any case in all of these states. And I think the question is, are we going to spend it towards this end that's going to get us to these goals of a clean, reliable, affordable grid? Or are we just going to kind of keep it business as usual, not go through these hard steps to get to something that works? There's a chicken and egg problem when you think about this legislative piece, and as Tony was referring to, kind of getting the specifics clear so that everybody can decide if we want to all stand together, you know, hold hands and get into the shallow end of this pool and actually move forward in this process. And we spent a lot of time talking about these things already, but there's a lot more talking to do. I think NRDC is recommending that the California legislature put forward simple legislation at this point that directs the ISO to work, the existing California ISO, to work in collaboration with the rest of the western states, those that have the Pacific Core footprint and other states who are interested, to come up with a acceptable governance proposal. And there's guidance that can be provided in a statute without getting so specific that includes transparent greenhouse gas accounting that absolutely respects state interests and that has a diverse advisory group representing a broad set of stakeholder interests. That would allow the conversation to kind of get out of that forum and I think create an amount of good faith for all of the states and region to work together towards this end. With that, I'll go into the specific points. And I'll combine the state authority and the question on the body of state regulators because I think it goes to the point of you don't necessarily know what you want on any given topic until you understand the bigger picture. When it comes to state authority, I think it's important to remember that FERC already exists in the West. PacifiCorp is a FERC-regulated transmission-owning entity, and that's just a fact. And states' traditional authority over transmission siting, over certification of transmission doesn't change whether or not PacifiCorp is acting as the transmission owner in the region or whether or not a regional grid operator that PacifiCorp is part of is acting as that FERC-regulated entity for certain purposes. There's several ways for states to influence outcomes in RTOs, and actually we just are putting out a paper today on making sense of governance structures and the potential role of states. In addition to Section 205 filings, which we've already talked about, we talk about heightened stakeholder status in other ways, meaning in PJM, for example, separate from the organization of state regulators, the states get to meet with the ISO related to transmission policy issues specifically, and they have a special role there. That's another way. Another way is simply by the deference that is paid to states in these processes in general. FERC pays deference to states. I know there are Supreme Court cases we can all debate that are notable cases where we can argue that, but in general, when a state shows up with a concern, FERC is interested in listening to it or has demonstrated that. And so there's just some reality to being a state. And so when you think about these different kinds of influences that the state can hold, think about the whole picture, which brings me to the 205 filing rights question. I think, Dee, you mentioned that the proposal goes farther than any of the existing 205 allowances for state committees in the other regions. And I think there's a real legal question there about whether we can get away with that. But I think there's a practical question there as well. And there's a little bit of kind of be careful what you wish for in terms of ensuring that the benefits that are out there to accrue from the creation of a regional operator can actually happen. And you can just as easily mire down in kind of indecision between states with diverse policy objectives. And that happens in different regions of the country. And we don't want to lose the reliability, the efficiency, and the environmental efficiencies that can come from this regional platform. And so in that case, I think the idea that a state could effectively quash the right of an RTO to submit a Section 205 filing is a really big deal, and it might not necessarily be the best way forward. The idea that the state regulators would take over the board of the ISO kind of might keep me up tonight, but there's a lot of politics on that side as well, and so I think the idea of an independent board that comes out of the history of RTOs and many other types of organizations before that has merit, and there's a reason for that. I think on the transition committee point, I think the proposal seems like a reasonable way to deal with the current realities that we're trying to go from a system that's California-based to a multi-regional grid operator, and we do point to the EIM as a really good model for that. It allows us, kind of similar to the legislation question, it allows the step forward, but still provides time where the parties are already invested in making it work to come to good outcomes and to spend money well towards the success of a regional grid operator. And I think most importantly is that stakeholder groups, including environmental and environmental justice NGOs, including consumer advocates, including independent power, including labor, including all of the people around the table and others, have the chance to have influence on that transitional committee, ideally with classes of voting rights, but at least significant influence. On the GHG point, I think I would just say the EIM has made progress in tracking transparent greenhouse gas emissions. In PJM and ISO New England, they do it for RGGI, and it's not that big of a deal. There's even a market monitor mechanism that it kind of sets off an alarm if it looks like a proper allowance price isn't being bid in to the market. And I'll end with stakeholder participation, which, of course, as an environmental NGO, is one of our biggest concerns. The California ISO currently, it does demonstrate best practices across the country when it comes to engaging with stakeholders. The staff is accessible, the board is accessible, and the idea is that when a regional grid operator is stood up, that should be one of the things that is maintained. It is really important. I know we don't want to get mired down. I spend a lot of days in weird hotels in St. Louis in the corner of a dark room negotiating market rules, but especially for those of us who don't have access to senior staff on a regular basis, who don't have our resources for engineers, who don't have access kind of in our regular interactions with the leaders of a grid operator, those stakeholder processes are really important for us to understand what's going on and to be able to make our points. I think on an advisory committee there needs to be, and on a nominating committee in the long term, there needs to be a voting role for advocate groups. And I think I'll leave it there. Thanks.
I was going to make an observation and then a question. In terms of the transitional committee, which had a variety of members, obviously Carl was very strong there too, we all voted unanimously in support of it. Having said that, I'm not sure it precisely reflected the views of any one individual as much as the process of compromise that was developed so that everyone was comfortable with it, although, again, it might not have been precisely, for some sections, precisely what Tony would have suggested or precisely what Dee Dee would have suggested. So, again, the hope is that whatever transitional committee comes out of this, assuming there's one, that, again, they work towards a unanimous recommendation. My question was, you talked about how you looked at best practices. Obviously, Mark Joseph was talking about the contrast between expert panel, you know, versus a political body? And what's your sense of how that's worked around the country? My impression was most or more in the expert panel, or, you know, box as opposed to the political box.
In terms of the boards of the ISOs? Yeah, that's right, and I appreciate the question because it reminded me of one last point, which is that in the multi-state RTOs that exist, they view the leadership of those RTOs have said in many occasions that they view themselves as facilitating all of these states' public policies, and that is what FERC requires them to do. And they are not the policymakers, but they are making sure that no state is blocked from implementing their own policy. And we see that, and I think the complement is that the organization of the states, the body of state regulators, is actually pretty able to function in a lot of ways pretty well together to give advice to that technical senior staff at the RTO on what they'd like to see studied, on what kind of policies they'd like to ask about, on what kind of market rules they're wondering about. We see that with the Clean Power Plan in both the Mid-Continent ISO and in PJM, the Mid-Atlantic region, where you've got a set of states with really diverse political interests and policy preferences, but who have been able to come together to propose kind of sets of studies and questions and ideas to the ISO to do analysis on their behalf to give them all information.
Two questions. You mentioned your concern with a stalemate if there's a strong state regulator authority. Are the information we've heard from SPP and MISO, which probably are the most robust form of state authority, is that there hasn't been stalemate, there's been a lot of cooperation. I'm wondering if you've had a different experience.
In any given situation, there might be a different experience, but no, I haven't. But they're not the board of the ISO, right? If it was changed so that they, as the body of state regulators, were put in charge of policy, they are in charge of policy. If they were put in charge of running the RTO, but also in the role of deciding policies, there's a real conflict there, in addition to potential legal issues when it comes to what an RTO has the authority to do.
Maybe I misunderstood you. Do you see concerns in the proposal, the strong role defined for state regulators where they have primary authority and can direct FERC filings on areas carved out for their authority that's in the proposal? Are you saying you see concerns with FERC accepting that level of deference or that level of control with the state body of regulators?
Yes, I see. Sorry, yeah, I do. I see what you're asking. I see a concern on the legal side that FERC would allow the body of states to actually, you know, say no, ARC regional grid operator, you can't file anything. I think that the practice in SPP and MISO, whereby the state regulators have a complementary authority to submit something that is an alternative, is enough to give the states assurance that that influence is going to happen during the RTO process that gets to that proposal, so that ideally you only have one.
All right, and the second question is, you started off by saying you think the legislature should authorize the ISO to engage in governance discussions with other states, or that's what I thought I heard you say, and I'm wondering exactly what you mean and what does that do beyond what we have under current law right now and what's already happening.
We're trying to think about a constructive way to move there's a reality that the California legislature has to make a decision on whether or not this effort continues to move forward. And because governance is such a key issue, as we're hearing around the table, you're trying to propose a way that might constructively have the California legislature give their view, put their perspective on the situation, and then pass it off to the stakeholders to come up with a proposal that ultimately all the states are going to have to be comfortable before it happens.
Well, the legislature has to authorize a change to the current governance structure, and that's different than the legislature giving their perspective. And I'm trying to tease out from you, is it the former or the latter? Do you think the legislature should, say, encourage further discussions but withhold any approval till next year or the year after? Do you think they should authorize a governance change right now and then say, go forth and figure out all the details
that we've started to talk about.
We think they should authorize the governance change without getting to the level of specifics that are provided that are causing concern amongst all of us, and give us all the chance to have those conversations once it's out of that forum.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Clemens, if you could, in your written comments, if you could highlight some of those areas. I had a similar question as Cliff did about how that, obviously in stark contrast to Tony, in terms of having everything laid out before you move. So be curious how you see that working. Thank you. Matt Friedman.
Thanks. Matt Friedman, I'm a staff attorney with the Utility Reform Network, and I want to give a few introductory remarks, and then I'll go through each of the items identified in the governance principles. Just to start by saying, this is potentially the most significant change in the electric sector in California since deregulation and the enactment of AB 1890. It's a serious proposal that could have significant consequences, and it's probably a one-way street, meaning it would be very difficult to undo even if things go poorly. Not impossible, but difficult. And this means that we need to take time to work through the details before we green light the expansion. This means time to work through the studies, which are preliminary at this point, to develop more understanding of what policies would govern various elements of the ISO's operations, and to look at what the governance structure would be, and to understand what rights and obligations all of the different participating transmission owners would have. This is the way, in my view, that we end up knowing whether it's actually being done right, if that's the goal, rather than just to do it. We're concerned that there is a real rush right now to get the legislature to sign off on this in the next 2 to 3 months. There's no way that these details get resolved by that time, and there's no way that we've had enough opportunity to do real critical analysis within the next 2 months. And urgency typically leads to bad policy making. So we want to avoid a situation where it's 11:30 at night in an August evening and we're sitting trying to figure out what rules we want to agree to because the vote is tomorrow. 12 months ago, no one was discussing this issue, maybe a few folks, but it was not certainly part of the public debate. And now there's a sense that it has to be done immediately. I would suggest that if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right and making sure that we work through things first. The big question in my mind is, if the legislature is asked to authorize governance changes and negotiations with other states, will there be another chance to review the terms and the conditions and the governance structure and whatever is negotiated after that first approval takes place? There may be many concessions made to other states in the West. There may be concessions made to other participating transmission owners. And FERC itself may not simply approve what's presented to it. It may modify the proposal. Has California given up its leverage and its ability to pull back with a one-time approval? That's something we should avoid. And on that last point, we understand that there is a transition agreement that's being negotiated right now between ISO and PacifiCorps, which would may or may not be complete before the legislature is asked to sign off on changes. And the transition agreement could include many specific concessions. We don't know quite what's in that, but certainly we'd want to see that complete and know the terms of that agreement before the legislature is asked to move forward. To get to the specific elements of the proposal, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff here. And so even though I'm going to focus on criticism, that doesn't mean that there aren't elements that we think make a lot of sense. Preservation of state authority, we could talk a long time on this, but I'll just say that we do have concerns about California's ability to continue to lead as an innovative policy leader as part of a regional market. And we don't know what the next iteration of policies are going to look like in this state, and I may not agree with every idea that's proposed in the legislature, but I certainly support California's right to consider making even crazy choices about how we want our future to be developed. And state authority is really at risk in several respects, and this proposal focuses on the ISO taking actions to infringe or preempt state policies. But there's also private litigation by private parties against the state of California, and there are petitions to FERC. And these are the ways that a lot of state policies have recently gotten in the news from some high-profile cases, including the Supreme Court decision that struck down the Maryland law, which was initiated by a private party. And just yesterday, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down or affirmed the district court striking down of a Minnesota law that prohibited utilities in their state from entering into bilateral contracts for new coal-fired generation in the region. Some of these conflicts between ISO rules and policies and state law may only be identified through private litigation. And there are lots of scenarios we could spin out where folks could raise various challenges against California policies. Suffice to say that there's no certainty here, and the creation of a single regional market that California is a part of raises the risk that our policies are put in the crosshairs. And there are certainly proposals even today that the ISO has put forward, for example, on resource adequacy, that already suggest a potential diminishment of state authority. The second issue was greenhouse gas.
Matt, just, on the private litigation, your point is that even if the state's in alignment with the ISO board, that some generator, someone else could challenge a policy and leading to litigation risk that's exacerbated by regionalization?
Certainly, it increases the pool of potential litigants. And I mean, when I look at, for example, the Eighth Circuit's decision yesterday, they spend a lot of time thinking about what MISO does and the relationship between the state's policy and the MISO operations. And so, I think in the minds of judges, certainly they are looking at the functioning of a regional ISO that is FERC regulated and giving a lot of deference to their ability to craft policies and market rules, and when states take actions that appear to be in conflict with those RTO rules, I think judges are potentially going to take a more critical view than they would if it's a state-level ISO. So,
well, I would encourage, to the extent you have any analysis of that decision or NRDC or EDF or anything, just file it in the docket, right?
Sure, be happy to do that. The second issue that's raised is greenhouse gas accounting, which isn't really about governance, but it's here, so let's talk about it for a minute. The proposal mentions the notion that the preliminary study results indicate that there will be a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions in California and regionally as a result of a Western Regional ISO in 2030. I want to take issue with this bullet point. I don't think it's even a correct characterization of the preliminary studies. One of the most important things, I think, is when we're looking at outcomes on greenhouse gas emissions, we should consider not only best-case outcomes. We should also look at intermediate-case outcomes and even worst-case outcomes. But the preliminary studies that the ISO has released are really focused on best-case outcomes.
But again, let's hold that for the next workshop.
Okay, well, then I'll just register my concern about
Point. Concern, but in writing. But again, next time we get together, let's dig into that.
Fair enough. Well, let's get to the particular proposal here because it actually does relate to the preliminary studies and how it would mesh with a tracking system. I think it's clear we do need a transparent methodology for tracking and accounting for greenhouse gas emissions, but it has to include all loads. The notion that the tracking system is really just specific to California's demand is a mistake. It's a very incomplete way of looking at the impacts on the region, and it ignores the scenario in which there is resource shuffling and significant amounts of leakage occurring. And I think that's something we might be seeing already in the EIM, and it's something that the preliminary studies from the ISO on SB 350 studies suggest would occur under regional expansion. And so really the goal here would be to have a region-wide source-to-sink tracking system for all environmental attributes associated with generation that are transacted in a regional ISO, and to make sure that the disclosure of that tracking is mandatory for all purchasers in that market. So good actors don't just get to report. I think all actors should have those emissions assigned to them, not that it's a regulatory obligation, but this is about transparency and disclosure and to understand happening across the entire footprint. This is pretty important. The third issue is transmission owner withdrawals. Certainly this is a good safety valve. The question is whether it really represents the nuclear option that can't actually be exercised. It's nice to know that we can leave if things go wrong, but might FERC decide not to let a state leave or a set of transmission owners? Might FERC change one of these provisions? Hard to tell. So I think it's good to have it in here, but I don't know that we would place too much reliance on it as a robust protection in a practical sense. Items 4 and 5 relate to the Transitional Committee of Stakeholders and initial board and transition period. We don't have a lot to say here, except that so far the stakeholder processes we've been involved in at the ISO have left us underwhelmed. And so I don't know whether the stakeholder committee ends up also being an underwhelming process. I guess that remains to be seen. But the key thing here is that to the extent that a committee of stakeholders or a transition board is developing new policies and rules, I think we want to make sure at the end of that process California gets a chance to relook at what's been done between today's draft and what we get at the end of that process to see whether the end result is something that the state of California can actually agree with and whether FERC approves any of these changes or modifies them in ways that are totally unpalatable to the political establishment. Items 6 and 7 address the composition of the regional ISO board and the body of state regulators. I think, in my view, I'm not placing a lot of stock in the value of an independent board to protect California's interests. And also, it's not clear to me that the board really would play such a significant role. My observation to date is that the ISO is really run by management and staff, and so that's where that's where the work gets done, and I'm not optimistic that an independent board would somehow dig deep into the details and take charge of the regional organization. I think they're more there to give their votes at the end of the day and not to really drive the agenda. So the regional board, to me, looks more like management running the show, but the establishment of a body of state regulators, that's something different. So I like Mark Joseph's idea. Make that the board. But if you can't do that, the question comes up, what actual issues wouldn't go through the body of state regulators? The draft references policy issues would go through. And I think I know what a policy issue is, but I can also imagine a lot of future arguments about different proposals that turn out to look like policy issues but not be. So maybe more clarity on that would be welcome over time. I mean, is it all cost allocation issues? What about additions of new transmission operators, market rules, and again, emerging issues that we don't even know about today? Those are things we'd be concerned about. And then the other issue that I noticed in reading the draft is that the ISO board can override a recommendation of the state regulators if it's for a reliability purpose. And I'm not sure I know exactly what reliability does and doesn't mean. A lot of bad outcomes in California have been justified on the basis of reliability, and they look like something else in hindsight. So just want to be careful that that doesn't become the exception that swallows the rule. And then finally, on stakeholder processes and participation, this is a topic of great interest. We haven't been historically very involved in CAISO processes, but we are learning in real time what it's like to be a stakeholder and thinking about what a future set of processes could look like that would be meaningful. The first thing is, right now the CAISO is subject to open meeting requirements consistent with the Bagley-Keene Act, and it's obligated to provide public access to corporate records consistent with the requirements of the California Public Records Act. Would those same protections be applied to a regional ISO? Not clear. In terms of process concerns, unlike other state agencies like the Energy Commission and the PUC, the ISO has no formal process for considering evidence and weighing comments submitted by individuals. The solicitation of stakeholder input has a nice informal feel to it, but there's something lacking because it's not clear to us that these stakeholder processes are providing genuine opportunities to affect decisions. Proposals before the ISO should be subject to discovery of underlying analyses and data, opportunities to present opposing viewpoints, and meaningful opportunities to evaluate the evidence. Right now, CAISO has no obligation to respond to comments, to give weight to alternative perspectives, to justify its own factual assumptions, or to explain what comments were relied upon in making its decisions, and this is troubling. And our experience with the current stakeholder processes, and if you asked other stakeholders, you might hear from many of them a similar experience, it's been discouraging. There's no clear rules, kind of changing proposals and timelines, and it feels, unfortunately, especially on this issue, like a highly politicized process that's driving the outcomes. So we think that we don't know what the right stakeholder process looks like at a future ISO, but it shouldn't look like the one that exists today. Also, we think it's important that in any regional entity that there's opportunities for access to confidential data or models subject to non-disclosure agreements that are relied upon. Right now, we have signed the NDA related to the SB 350 studies, and our initial experience is that there's a lot of material in there that doesn't look that confidential, and so we're kind of wondering why there's been a designation of so much confidentiality, and what's the remedy, by the way? Who do we go to challenge that? Not clear at all. Probably nobody. Finally, the cost of participating in CAISO stakeholder processes can be significant. And at a regional ISO where you have even more processes, it's like you need full-time staff just to work on that issue and full-time consultants if you want to be a successful participant. And if you don't have that kind of resource available, then all you've got are well-funded entities, utilities, and independent generators that can really show up at all of the meetings and can pursue intervention also at FERC, because FERC is the ultimate decider on all of these issues related to the ISO. So there's a proposal that's been circulated for a compensation structure for nonprofit groups that demonstrate hardship. We think that is kind of a minimum but not sufficient condition for moving forward, and it should certainly be available to a wide array of public interest stakeholders, including environmental groups like NRDC and Greenlining, low-income advocacy groups, and consumer organizations to allow effective participation. If this doesn't happen, it's not clear that you're going to have many California stakeholders apart from utilities and independent generators that are going to be able to devote much time to participating in all of these processes. So thanks for the opportunity to talk, and happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, I think the one that was most striking is you started out by saying Karen has not participated much in the stakeholder processes. Certainly, I've typically asked parties who have participated what they think, and they've been relatively supportive. So basically, again, trying to understand going forward, obviously, in any of these processes, one can always do better, and certainly the NDA issues, I understand, you come back to the, it's been a huge issue on PUC stuff of making sure people have access to the modeling inputs so they can actually challenge what's going on, so sympathize quite a bit there. But I think going forward, again, we need to look at the stakeholder process, but one of the things I'm at least taking into perspective, your issues, at the same time we're hearing a lot of support. So.
Yeah, well, we're doing our best to get up to speed. I think maybe part of the frustration you're hearing is that we're currently part of a stakeholder process that is on a highly expedited schedule where proposals keep changing, and we've already submitted 4 data requests to the ISO in the SB 350 study process, and I know they've been doing their best to be responsive, but we don't feel like we have nearly the kind of information that we need to file comprehensive comments by next Wednesday. And so the deadlines have been really tight. We're not clear what's driving the expedited timelines. And if we were in a PUC proceeding, I feel like we'd have a lot better opportunity to dig deeper into the factual data that was being proposed. We would have the opportunity to more discovery, and we'd be able to provide better quality analysis. So if the goal is to give people an opportunity to do good work and provide useful feedback, then I don't know that the CAISO process that we've been involved with right now is cutting it, and I know talking to other stakeholders involved in it, many groups are kind of throwing up their hands saying it's just too much to deal with.
Okay, that's a real concern on all of our parts. I would note, though, obviously I've been in both FERC proceedings and PUC proceedings, and FERC is a lot more judicial in nature than the PUC. So if you ever get to that stage, believe me, it's serious stuff. You know, well
know
beyond what you used to at the PC.
Or dissed.
No, it's just real it's
a compliment.
Yeah.
Compliment.
Right.
Any other questions? Okay, Mr. Friedman, I just have a comment. I'd ask you in your written comments to try to address this, and I think most people in the room are sort of part of the energy literati, so they know where the organizations are forming around this issue. And you have those who say they want to do it right, but they also say at the same time they want to take more time. And I don't know if more time is necessarily going to help you get it right. I don't think anyone wants to get it wrong, but there are people that want to expedite this and move it along. And Ms. Clemens, for example, would like to have it in more free form and work on it as you go along. On the other side of that is a notion that anyone in business knows, that time kills all deals. So in the interest of good faith, is it worthwhile, from your perspective, setting a deadline or something that would give confidence that this is not just some Fabian tactic to grind the other side down? But just, you don't have to answer it now, but I think at some point, I mean, everybody knows that that's in the back of everybody's mind. When someone says, take more time, it means, you know, we're going to drag this thing out and maybe let it grind it down. On the other hand, you raise legitimate points that need to be dealt with, and hopefully this time given there. So I just ask you, is there some happy medium there where we can agree on, you know, by this date we've got to move, or some other way of doing that?
Fair enough. We'll think about that.
I mean, you know what I'm talking about. Thank you. Okay. Rachel Gold.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Rachel Gold. I'm the Policy Director for the Large Scale Solar Association. We represent developers, owners, and operators for a good portion of the solar that's up and running in California and many other projects around the West. And I'm pleased to be back here to be talking about these issues. LSA, like many around the table, really does want to get this right. Reflecting on Chair Weisenmiller, your opening comments, you know, we really share the goals of having the RSO as a key element in transforming a grid to a modern grid that can really bring reliability benefits and integration benefits and cost savings. So when we're looking at these proposals, just to start, I think this these principles are a good starting place. And they are reflective of many of the issues that have already been raised advance the conversation. And I think the next place that we'd like to see them go is to have some more specificity on a number of issues. And I'll talk about those in a minute. At a high level, I do want to commend the ISO and all the folks who have been working on this for presenting us with a starting place and a formal starting place. So some of the issues where we'd like and we think there'd be a benefit for further development are on some key issues around the final governance structure to make sure that we have a workable division of labor and really understand how some of the, you know, voting processes and policies will be established. And one of the places to start, I think, is to have some further details on how the transitional committee will be formed, what kinds of rules and decision-making structure that committee will have. We've heard, we didn't participate directly, but we have engaged with the EIM Transitional Committee, and we've heard good things about that process that have been mentioned here today. But I think having a greater understanding about whether that structure is the intent here or if there are going to be kind of different rules about how that will be developed and who and how we'll decide who's going to be participating there will be important. And related to that, I think having a commitment and a structure for a more open stakeholder process in parallel to that will be an important element of moving that work forward and ensuring that we can have a broad array of diverse voices engage on these issues. When we are, our lens obviously is thinking about how independent power producers and solar in particular will have a role in this process and understanding how and where certain decisions are going to be made. And so establishing some of those pieces in terms of the transitional committee's role I think will be key. And moving to the proposal, just section by section, on preservation of state authority, I think the proposal is a good start, and we definitely support those elements around retention of procurement authority and other key policy issues that a number of other commenters have already commented quite extensively on. So I'll just say, let's go from there. And on greenhouse gas accounting, this is really important work, and we look forward to that stakeholder process getting started and think it's going to be a key element in the overall proposal that we'll take a look at. But we don't have specific comments on what's in the proposal other than encourage that work starting soon, which we know is slated. On the issue of PTO withdrawal. Here I think there would be some benefit for some additional further details in the proposal. I think we support having a withdrawal provision. We noticed in the most recent Florio Jones proposal that there were some other elements that could be useful, including ensuring that the retention of the current notice provisions, consideration of exit fees, and of any kind of dispute resolution process. So we hope that into that conversation we'll comment further on that in our written comments. I've already spoken somewhat about the transitional committee, and what I'd like to add here is that it would be helpful for going into any transitional committee for there to be some really clearly specified goals and more delineated roles in terms of what that committee is going to take on. There was a pretty short time frame and process proposed here, and those issues are a lot broader than what was undertaken in the EIM transitional committee. So we're sensitive to the fact that there's a lot to do, and we should be really specific and prioritize what needs to go first there. And one of those things is probably really digging into what are the relevant qualities and how we'd like to see any nomination process go forward for either the transitional board or the more formal board. I think that's probably good there, unless you have questions on that. On the initial board and the transitional elements of that, I think we support generally there being some kind of transition and find that a necessary element. We don't have a lot of specifics to offer because I think we'd like to know more about how different states will participate in nominating their members and whether or not there would be any kind of change to the current voting structure as part of that transitional board take that into account in understanding kind of the overall governance of the future RSO. I already spoke a little bit about the composition of the regional board in itself, but I'll just state again that I think having the transitional committee define early the relevant areas of expertise, or if we go in the direction of a more state-appointed board, kind of what those roles and elements for good board members look like that will make sure that we have an effective body will be really important. Encourage more thinking on that earlier in the process. On the body of state regulators, we generally support a body of state regulators. We have some questions about what policies the Board of State Regulators will hold and what will be part of an expert board. That a number of folks have commented on that this afternoon. And particularly, curious about whether or not the thinking here is to have a Board of State Regulator that will be approving policy decisions or developing them. I think as Matt mentioned, we see mostly a staff-driven process today at the CAISO on both transmission planning and on policy issues and that coming before the expert board. So I think thinking through about whether or not a Board of State Regulators will hold and also that planning and development aspect will be an important piece for us to understand. And related to that, I'd like to think through how the rules and policies will be developed for that Board of State Regulators. One of the challenges that Tony mentioned and that we've noted as well is that in the current stakeholder process, some of the work around benefit test assessment in the TAC proceeding and some of the other key issues are being pushed off for the transitional committee to decide potentially or for the Board of State Regulators. But we're not sure who will decide what those tests and policies will be, and that puts us in a tough position in terms of assessing the overall framework that we're going to be dealing with. And I think from the IPP perspective, we want to understand early how decisions will be made and on what basis for new transmission lines or for, NRA issues and the like. So further definition of some of those pieces, I think, early in the process. Finally, on the stakeholder process, I spoke about this when we met several weeks ago, that LSA has found in many instances that the stakeholder process at the ISO has been a pretty good one, and we think there are elements in areas where it can be improved, and we're open to talking about that and thinking through that. We want to understand what the role of independent generators will be in those processes and how we can ensure that our issues and voices are heard, and many, much like everyone around the table. In establishing the rules for the transitional committees, I think that will help us understand kind of where that's heading and perhaps some additional guidance about, what the goals are for any improvements would be a way to further develop that at this point. And with that, I just want to say that I think we're kind of in the middle ground of wanting to see some additional details at this point to further understand the whole package, but not needing to have the whole package developed today. I'm open to any questions you have.
Thank you. Any questions from the bench?
Yeah, just a quick question, and certainly encouraging everyone, is we struggle with this question of how well baked does that to be now versus later. If in your written comments you could give more thought to which of the elements getting further fleshed out would help, if possible. And
absolutely.
That would be good. Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Grant.
Thank you. Sakita Grant with the Green Lining Institute. I'm legal counsel with the Environmental Equity Team. And just as background, the Green Lining Institute is an environmental equity organization. We work in close partnership with environmental justice groups and really representing the voice of disadvantaged communities in these conversations. I think overall we find the proposal to be a very good start. As Rachel put it, it's an effective way to advance the conversation and put pen to paper on some of these issues. So I'm going to just march through most of these 8 points in as effective of a manner as possible and efficient. So I think echoing, I don't think there's anybody in this room or engaged in this process that doesn't agree with really prioritizing the preservation of state authority. I think for disadvantaged communities, there is some anxiety around ensuring that any path we go down does not interfere with really aggressive and robust efforts to expand access to clean energy technologies within disadvantaged communities, particularly distributed resources. And within, from a governance standpoint, along these lines, we have questions on what's the enforcement mechanism here? So to the extent there might be a direction that this regional body would take on that seems to be counter to state policies, you know, what's the path of recourse for groups around the table and other groups that might want to challenge and ensure that we're not seeing unintended consequences? We have the same concerns that Matt does around private litigation, understanding that there's, you know, a good argument that how is this much different from what's already in place with the IEM, the EIM. However, as Matt has pointed out, there is some good reason to think that in the court system there could be additional complications, and how do we get the best and brightest attorneys to figure out, you know, really ensuring that we have something that moves forward that can protect against private litigation that might lead to erosion of the great policies we have in place and the future policies we will have in place. On greenhouse gas accounting, I think the environmental justice community has and is learning a lot about some of the potential unintended consequences that can result from robust greenhouse gas emission reduction mechanisms, and what it means for local pollutants, for co-pollutants. So we really from, and understanding that there's going to be a further discussion on this, but from the governance standpoint, what's the adaptive management mechanism that we could have in place that will allow us to correct and prevent unintended consequences and really prevent us from going down too far down the wrong path. And supporting Matt's comments on this around tracking, we support that. And in addition to greenhouse gas emissions, looking at the tracking of co-pollutants with a specific focus on geographic regions, and really the purpose is to avoid unintended consequences to already burdened, pollution burdened communities. And also with that, having a plan around mitigation to the extent there are spikes in or increases in emissions in certain communities. And so this all is consistent with Professor Joseph's history lesson, which is how do we really have those mechanisms in place to ensure that we can correct and make this this regionalization something that improves, and we're not stuck in something that's detrimental to Californians, particularly disadvantaged communities. For the transmission owner withdrawal, we are supportive. Take heed of Tony's remarks around whether, you know, how this would actually function in practice. And I don't know enough about the issue to make detailed comments, but we would be interested in making sure that this is actually realistic. For the transitional committee, also supportive of this, I think the only question we had is around checks and balances. So it looks like the ISO board would appoint the committee. I don't know if there's an opportunity for consultation with the governor's office or legislature or something that adds an additional set of eyes to that selection process. The initial board and transition period, I'm not going to add to what other folks have said on that. I think just skipping down to the body of state regulators, we are supportive. And just want to flag the importance of the preservation, that we preserve the majority of load clause to ensure that California has sufficient control and votes in that process. And then the final section on the stakeholder process. It sounds like there's different opinions on whether the California ISO's stakeholder process to date is a sufficient one. I think we would side on there needing to be a close look at how to improve it. There's particularly working with community-based organizations, it is hard to engage in the process. It's incredibly technical. It requires a lot of resources, and I think would support Matt's comments on that. And what's listed here, the three sub-bullets on improving the process, the possibility of funding mechanism, we would recommend additional workshopping, more transparency. These are all things that sound great. Right now as written, it looks like we're drafting it to kind of consider these different things and would really urge that as if things move forward that we're taking these more seriously and actually committing to them. So I think I'll leave it at that, and if there's any questions.
Just that last point, you said you recommend more workshops to flesh out those proposals or more workshops as part of the new stakeholder process that's
right.
established.
Right, the latter. So not to figure out what it looks like, but really to ensure that there's robust community engagement. These are things that the Energy Commission has embarked on doing more on this year, and we're getting a lot of great reception on it. And it's about bringing in stakeholder groups that aren't kind of, as we call it, the usual suspects around the table, but bringing in stakeholder groups that wouldn't normally participate.
Okay. I had a question and a comment. You know, on the question side, to the extent that the 350 studies include looking at some of the environmental, some of the impacts on disadvantaged communities, I wanted to see, make sure that you had the opportunity to really dig into that, or you know, to the extent you need any additional briefings from the ISO, whatever, that was going to urge the ISO to schedule that. I think that would help.
Yeah, I think we have been engaged on that, and I think it would be useful to have further conversations with the ISO and as well as the consultants that are working on that. It becomes difficult. A lot of the work done there really depends on involvement, even from the point of what are the inputs into the models and what's being considered in the beginning. And I think we missed the boat on that one. But certainly, I think we would take the ISO up on the opportunity to have further discussions.
Yeah, and I was going to note, in terms of the existing transitional committee that was set up for EIM, that was done by the ISO board. And I would have to say they did a phenomenal job on selection, so it would certainly discourage governor's office, legislature, cast of thousands, getting involved in the process. I would also note, having been on the committee, it was a hell of a lot more work than I ever knew when I signed up.
Yeah.
So, you know, certainly if anyone's approached on it, keep that in mind. But
Thank
any
you.
Other questions from the dais? Okay. We'll turn now, last but not least, to my fellow classic car lover, Mark Smith from Calpine.
Thank you. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a practitioner at the ISO. I have made appeals many times in front of the former chair of the ISO, and I'm sure me being last with no time is a reflection of some of the things I may have said to Mr. Foster at different times. Calpine thinks that the proposal is absolutely directionally correct. It eventually would create an independent board with an understanding that the states have important and necessary roles in the energy business and that those roles can be exercised within their jurisdiction. We would prefer to get to that endpoint sooner than the proposal suggests. That's a hint at some of my future comments here. But nonetheless, the other thing that I think is very important that we want to highlight is that as we move forward, certainly the structure that we design needs to be acceptable to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I was struck by the fact that nowhere in the presentation from the ISO, and I've talked with Roger about this since, was there a discussion of any filings for this at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, nor requests for approval? We think that many of these elements need to be reviewed by and approved by FERC in order for the subsequent steps, which might be the expansion of the market to other areas. So we suspect, and probably the ISO is having informal discussions with FERC commissioners and FERC staff to make sure that this structure passes the grade, but we really encourage a consideration of which elements of this need to be filed at FERC and an exposure of this. We sense that there's probably at least two, maybe three areas in which this may deviate from even the SPP model, which a lot of this is designed after. The SPP model has a regional state entity that has certain delegated responsibilities, very similar to the body of state regulators that's been proposed here. It's a very similar structure, but there are differences that we must highlight and address. The first of those is the independent standard that we've talked about. FERC's requirements for an RTO. Now, we can move forward without getting FERC's approval of an RTO, but FERC may have remedies that are distasteful to all of us if that's the case. In other words, they may delay decisions as they have in the past or not make decisions as they have in the past. FERC's regulations require an exclusive and independent right by the RTO to be able to file for rates. This is what we call Section 205 rights. It can be shared, as it has been in MISO and it has been in SPP, but it can't be excluded, which we see as the real structure or possibility of some of the restrictions within the proposal that's in front of us. We think that that needs to be addressed. The restrictions, for instance, are that the body of state regulators can direct certain filings and the ISO doesn't have the opportunity to file a competing proposal. The ISO can only make filings during certain emergency conditions, the exclusions that we've already talked about. Secondly, we think that any delegations of responsibility, any sharing of responsibility needs to be identified in the tariff and reviewed by FERC. Therefore, we think that writing bylaws to the ISO, and to my knowledge and experience in working on the EIM Transition Committee, bylaws are not necessarily filed, nor reviewed, nor approved by FERC. But writing a delegation of authority essentially into a bylaw seems like a dangerous precedent if indeed we want FERC ultimately to approve this whole structure. So putting it in front of FERC and letting FERC review the delegations of authority. And Commissioner Picker, you're absolutely right. Defining those things in the EIM Transition Committee we found to be difficult. As Tony has said, if someone could define what the state jurisdiction was very clearly to me, as it continues to move, we could do that. It's going to be very difficult, I think, to expressly do it. Now, in SPP and MISO, they've been successful in at least identifying a couple of areas in which there was an approved delegation. The third area, I guess, that I've had this thing for 4 days, right? I think all of us have had it for about 4 days. The third area that I'm concerned about is the creation of a separate legal entity, which is the body of state regulators in this case, and delegating authority to them without them having any FERC jurisdictional interface or exposure or responsibility. I don't understand the full regulatory oversight of that group and how it would work out, but it's something that I think collectively we need to understand and explore a little bit better. It seems quite different than what SPP and MISO had done. MISO, I believe the state group is just a committee of the ISO. I'm not so clear on what SPP has done. So I think for the benefit of the ISO in the next iteration, I think those are three areas at least that we really do need to explore, expand, and understand. Of those, I think Calpine particularly is most concerned with the limits on independence of the ISO that would be created by certain events. I am just going to talk about two other things, I think. The Transition Committee of Stakeholders, I think it's a great idea. On the EIM Transition Committee, we had, I think, a great benefit of having a set of principles or guardrails that were given to us so that we were tasked with implementing policies that have been created and established by the board rather than creating policy. And I would be very concerned if this committee, this transitional committee, was tasked with creating policy. That's a little different than where we were. The initial board and the transition period, again, I want to get to the end point of the independent board as quickly as possible. And I think that it's a step that could be avoided, which is the transitional board, the interim board. And I'd like to have some more discussion about whether we should advance more quickly to that final and independent board. On the lighter side, Matt Friedman, I would say the ISO stakeholder process sucks. I think you know that very well. You've been involved in it. Unfortunately, it's probably, like democracy, the best one that's out there. Please don't expose us to the multi-level, multi-year organized stakeholder processes of the East. I think that we collectively in California and, you know, with our counterparts outside California can work more, much more productively in the structure that we have today. With that, I'd be happy to respond to any questions that you might have.
Yeah, I guess actually you raised an interesting question that I at least want people to think about in their responses, and that is for the regulatory body, how do we make sure there's some sort of transparency there in their decision making? You know, and, the other part of the issue is just realistically, you and I are used to acting in the sort of California context of the meeting, Bagley Keene, everything else. As you go across the various states in the West, obviously there's the equivalence or lack thereof in different states. So basically trying to figure out something that works but really is a transparent decision-making process, particularly if you're delegating some fairly important stuff to that committee.
I just wanted to point out that there are some specific delegated authorities in the MISO. I won't go through all of them, but I'll just kind of note that one of them that's very specific is their ability to operate the Market Monitoring Committee, which I assume has some direct linkage to FERC in terms of making referrals.
Any other questions?
No, I think so. Big round of applause, Bob, for getting us here.
I'd like to thank all the panelists for a thoughtful and thought-provoking session, and I want to apologize. I have failed in my moderator duties. I am 15 minutes over time, so I want you to keep that in mind if you ever think about having me do this again.
Thank you. Again, for those of you who are not familiar with Energy Commission processes, I need blue cards. From the parties who want to speak at this stage, and public advisor in the back, raise your hand. If you want a blue card, please approach her and get a blue card.
I'm going to apologize early. I have a meeting shortly, and so I'll probably have to leave after another 5-10 minutes to be able to get there in time.
Okay. So blue cards. And the first party we have is Imperial Irrigation District. Now, I've got three cards. Again, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Energy Commission process, but the answer is each party gets a card, a speaker. Given you've come a long way, I'm going to be a little bit, give you a little bit more freedom. But again, the closer you can get to 6 minutes as opposed to nine is good. But again, future time, one card. I don't want to be in a situation, say, where PG&E comes in with 20,000 people with cards or Green Lining with 10,000. So one card per party. Certainly encourage written comments. And now go on the docket. Written comments, we've given you the date on it. And certainly, again, you're welcome to provide written comments on stuff. And obviously I'm not particularly interested in hearing the deep nuts and bolts of your litigation. I'm sure there's a court somewhere that would deal with it, but I'm a scientist, not a judge.
Well, I'll be quick about it. As many of you know, I'm Kevin Kelly. I represent Imperial Irrigation District, the state's third largest public power provider and its own balancing authority, and it will surprise no one that I rise in favor of dinosaurs. Or perhaps the Balkans. I'm reminded, and I know my friend Bob Foster will recall the famous dictum of Tip O'Neill that all politics is local. And I think that what you have before you in this proposal is that all politics is actually regional, and we can find a way to make it local. I do want to salute the message discipline of the California grid operator. There was a time when we referred to this entity as the Cal ISO. I heard somebody call it the CAISO. It's a little too close to Casio, the consumer electronics manufacturer. But today, and I think for about the last year or so, virtually everyone from on staff with the ISO refers to it that way, the ISO, which leads me to believe that this entire process is almost a fait accompli.
Hang on one second. Apparently the audio has dropped off on the line. So fix it. Go ahead. Sure. Now that's, I've gotten a note. I don't know if that's generally true, but let's fix it.
That's okay. I really just want to talk to you anyway.
Presumably we've got a transcript too. So
what I'm seeing in this timeline is that this is going to happen this summer, and so the train's clearly left the station. It's a bullet train, and it's on steroids. And we're not just being asked to jump into the shallow end of a pool. We're all jumping into the deepest part of a roiling ocean, and the strongest swimmers have assured the rest of us who can only tread water that they'll save us. So putting the governance ahead of these larger questions, dangling questions, seems to me to be a strategy for bad policy. And I don't know how you reconcile a bill moving through the legislature right now to break up this clubby atmosphere that seems to permeate the CPUC, and at the same time find a vehicle for this proposal that will metastasize the ISO. I don't see how it serves California's public interest. It certainly doesn't serve Imperial Irrigation District's interest. And I don't see how it advances the governor's ambitious renewables and climate goals. So IID will oppose this. I'm sure that frightens no one. And we'll encourage our own county to oppose it. We don't like the way the ISO operates today, the size it is today, and we certainly don't relish the thought of it being even bigger. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for being here. I should note, we've had this before, I've gotten texts that people have audio and people who don't have audio, and some of we've got two different channels out. So, but we do have a transcript one way or another. Go ahead.
I'd like you to clarify, is this being broadcast as all the other comments were? Are my comments going to be broadcast?
I have gotten one note saying they hear, and I've got another note saying they don't. So having a look at it.
Today, my name is Michael Aguirre. I've spent the last 4 years investigating the actions of the CPUC, including Mr. Picker, Mr. Peavy, and others. And, of course, I want the record to reflect that Mr. Picker is leaving the room. The reason that the public and so many legislators are going to do away with the CPUC is because they support proposals like this one, and they support the kind of orchestrated propaganda presentation that you put on today. But I'm not going to get into that because I don't have enough time and you don't want to hear the truth, all the truth. But I will cover one point. ISO is a nonprofit corporation. It proposes to merge with a for-profit corporation. ISO proposed to cede control of its for-profit to for-profit parties the work that it does. The ISO, in doing so, cannot assure that the partnership will in fact be operated in furtherance of a charitable purpose. Under these circumstances, the ISO would lose its tax-exempt status should the merger be consummated. I refer to you to Redlands Surgical Services versus Commissioner 113, Tax Court 4778. The ISO reports it may seek a ruling from the Internal Revenue Service because it recognizes that it is operating, threatens, or its activities may take it outside of the nonprofit protection, and it's going to, or it proposes possibly seeking a ruling about the effect of the proposed governance changes on its tax-exempt status. It's not just it's those changes, but there are many others. I suggest before we go any further that a ruling from the Internal Revenue Service be secured with a proper presentation of what ISO plans to do to see if that satisfies its nonprofit status. Bloomberg refers to what's going on here as a $26 billion gamble by Pacific Corp in the Western electric markets. You all look, the CEC, the CPUC, the ISO, like you've merged. And we ought to have a future workshop on that about when that merger took place and when you began sitting in a building that's paid for with public funds, when you decided that you would become advocates for a not-for-profit corporation and a private agenda. And that's all this was here today. Here's what's going to happen. Just like with the CPUC, just like with the ISO, they make it absolutely impossible for the public to have an impact on public policy. And so what happens? It goes to the courts. You talked about transparency. The ISO takes the position that they don't have, there's no court that can order them to produce public records if they decide not to. The CPUC takes the position that only an appellate court can order them to do that. You're taking the position right now that you don't want to hear anything that's adverse, and from the people that raised issues that were adverse to your advocacy position, you confronted them and tried to argue them out of their position all day today. I'm done, but all I'm telling you is you will be in a different form at some point, and I want you to make sure that you keep all your emails, all your records of communication, and that goes for the governor's office, although they refuse to turn over their emails. They refuse to let us know about all those private dealings they're having with all those other states right now that they talk about, all the back channel.
Are you done?
No, not quite.
Well, but you're getting written comments.
No, my written comments don't go about what's happening today.
That's fine. You can, but you have subsequent written comments.
I would note
as you're getting forward that the witness for the city of San Diego on the IDB issue in the merger was myself.
Well, that's fine, and it's unfortunate that you've shifted and you've lost your focus for the public interest, because I know in the past you have been someone that has been an advocate, and it's always sad to see someone cross over the line and become a captive regulator, which you have been. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Last IID, and again, this is...
Thank you. Maria Severson, representing the Imperial Irrigation District, and I appreciate you extending the time the same way you did to the panelists who went over their time, so we appreciate that. First, I'd like to say that the invitation to comment and participate requires, and to get the reports that were made, were given to only those who had signed non-disclosure agreements. That goes against making this any type of real public process. There's a real issue as far as whether the public can determine whether the states that are like Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming, who have no renewable portfolio standards, where California has 50% renewable portfolio standards, whether there's going to be any interest in them taking our clean energy. The reports, we're not allowed to get them unless we signed a signed.
Well, again, the reports are a subsequent hearing, not this hearing.
The Pacific Corps, well, let me say this. The timing of this governance and attempt to make this regional grid is interesting because, one, why now and why so fast? Let's talk about why now. We have a broken regulatory scheme the Public Utility Commission is being thought to be disbanded by pending legislation right now because it is so broken. It goes to Warsaw to make secret deals for failed plants, and then the ISO comes in and says, let's talk about reliability and how we can plug in that energy. Let's do it with some greenhouse gas. And now there's a diversion here to suddenly make this the most important thing, to get this through quick. You know, is this the governor's high-speed railroad getting this thing through? Because it seems to be just to divert the attention. The timing of it is interesting, too, because just last week, 7 days ago, FERC found that PacifiCorp, it had revoked its market-based rate authority and several of its balancing areas authorities, and it ordered it to make refunds. It basically barred it from selling at market rate. This is the company that the ISO seeks to merge with. So the timing of this, it's too fast, it's not necessary, and it's just a diversion. Don't create something new. Fix what's broken in all your houses. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go on to Jonathan Weiskel.
Good afternoon. Jonathan Weiskel at Berkshire Hathaway Energy. We'll file written comments, of course, but just want to make a couple of very quick points. Mark Smith correctly pointed out that whatever governance proposals are derived will have to be acceptable to FERC. They'll also have to be acceptable to the other five states that, at least at this point, would be part of this process. In that regard, we're very supportive of these principles, but I would just urge folks to be careful that the greenhouse gas accounting not trample the deference to state authority. No question that this is important for California. My guess is it's probably less important for the other five states. So I think that's worth keeping in mind. But we certainly, as a company, support reporting in that account. That's certainly important. It has been successful in the energy imbalance market, and certainly should be important going forward. In that regard, that preservation of state authority, I just want to leave you with one last example, and it goes back to the opening of our session where Governor Goleadeva referred to what one of our other utilities, MidAmerican, is doing in Iowa. And just very briefly, a couple of statistics on MISO. Yes, our utility is announced will be 85% wind. Goal is to be at 100%, which we will achieve. We're members of a 15-state ISO, MISO. 12 of those 15 states are suing the EPA over the Clean Power Plan, 3 are not. Some of those states are over 90% dependent on coal. Our Mid-American energy is going in a different direction. Half of those states don't even have RPS standards. They have targets. Nevertheless, here are 15 states that, because of good governance of an RTO and deference to state authority, are able to do the job of an RTO while letting states preserve their own policies, procurement. Thanks very much.
Let's go to Elizabeth Kelly.
Very much. I'm Beth Kelly. I'm the General Counsel of MCE, a community choice aggregator. Very pleased to be here today. First, I just want to say that our goal as a CCA is to aggressively reduce GHGs and increase RPS, and so our interest in this regionalization is to ensure to the greatest extent possible that that's going to happen in California and region-wide. I just had one quick comment on the body of state regulators. I just wanted to note that the CPUC and presumably the other regulators don't regulate the procurement of all the load-serving entities that they serve, and that includes CCAs. And so when we're looking at the governance structure, I think that it is healthy to have that POU voice, non-voting voice, but I don't think that it's quite enough. And so we want to make sure that there are sufficient voices heard from all the relevant actors. And we'll provide written comments as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Nora Sharif, please.
Good afternoon. Nora Sheriff here on behalf of CLECA, the California Large Energy Consumers Association. CLECA is an ad hoc organization of large industrial customers, PG&E and Southern California Edison. We'll be filing written comments, but I wanted to echo some of the concerns that you've heard today in person while I'm here now. First, regarding the rushed process, these are complicated issues that we're dealing with, and there are lots of moving pieces and they interact. We need to wrestle with the details and see how they interact. Otherwise, it's not clear if the ratepayers will see any of the promised benefits of regionalization. I do agree with putting governance first. I think the proposal has some very positive aspects to it, and we'll comment on those. But as for Mayor Foster's request for a deadline or suggestions about a deadline, I think that SB 350 gave us a deadline, and that deadline is the end of next year. So I do think we can take the time that we need for this process to get it right. Thank you.
Thanks. Spotty Jones?
Thank you very much. I'm Jan Spotty Jones with the Independent Energy Producers Association, and I want to thank you for this opportunity to offer some comments. We will file a little more detailed comments in writing. We do have some concerns that I think were pretty well put forward by Mr. Smith. I do, however, want to go on record as thanking Governor Brown for basically advancing this idea, and I want to thank the members of this panel for listening to a wide variety of different interests that have concerns about how to do this and how to do this right. I think it is important. These issues are difficult enough without us creating some sort of X-File-esque type of conspiracy theory and response to my friends at IID. The fact of the matter is we do not have a merger underway here. We have the PacifiCorp transmission system joining the ISO as a participating transmission organ, owner. And that is different than a merger. No one's handing things over to the private sector to run the Cal ISO. This is an important distinction. Yes, it'll require the IRS to look at it. It's going to require FERC to look at it. It's probably going to require the State Attorney General to look at it. We are there is a number of steps that have to be taken. IEP is generally supportive of this effort, and why? And I did read the testimony earlier. There's not a solar snow job going on. There's actually a solar polar vortex. I think that's probably counterintuitive there. But the fact of the matter is, in 2001, we had basically 812 megawatts of utility-scale solar online in California. Or actually, it's 412. Today, it's over 7,800 megawatts and growing. And that's just utility-scale. That's not the 3,000 to 4,000 megawatts of rooftop. That's a lot of stuff in the middle of the day showing up. We have to have a larger footprint to be able to continue to grow the renewable energy industry in this state. So that's why this is important. I think, as you heard Mr. Smith speak as well, it is important for our existing assets to be used more efficiently. So we think that that's of critical import. There's obviously a balance of interest here with respect to the 205 filings that we will comment on a little further. I also want to point out, because this gets confused very quickly, whatever the state of California does or the existing ISO, it has to be consistent with the Commerce Clause and the Federal Power Act. And California has been pretty cautious in terms of how it's written its statutes, unlike Minnesota and unlike Maryland, to basically be consistent with the Federal Power Act and Commerce Clause, at least so far. But there's nothing, if we expand this footprint, I suggest that this can be done in a way that we do not expose ourselves to any additional risk of litigation. And by the way, we live in the United States of America, and under at least the current laws, individuals do have the right to file litigation when necessary. There are some significant issues that need to be taken up, the TAC, maybe stakeholder reformation, maybe tracking greenhouse gas issues. Those all need to be taken care of. Those can be done in parallel, as Mr. Braun had suggested. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Saddle City Light, excuse me. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Robert Cromwell with Seattle City Light. I'm the Director of Power Contracts and Resource Acquisition there. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. I just wanted to point out a few things. First, that fundamentally we recognize the challenge that California and eventually Oregon is going to face in achieving their environmental goals, and specifically integrating the very large volumes of renewable generation these states plan to deploy to meet those goals. Seattle City Light shares and supports these goals as necessary but not sufficient actions to address climate change. Seattle recognizes the operational challenges on the horizon for integrating these large quantities of renewables solely within a single state. At Seattle, we believe we can play a leadership role through the use of our hydroelectric capacity, storage, and energy in assisting California and Oregon in achieving these goals while also protecting and enhancing the economic foundation of the service that we provide to our customers. To be successful, a regional ISO's market is going to have to evolve to continue to support California's policy goals while respecting and supporting the policy goals of other states. This evolution will have to include not just governance structures, as Stacey ably described, but also the market design itself, and ultimately, and perhaps most challengingly, evolution of the organizational culture of the ISO. I'd like to gently suggest that it's in California's interest to unlock the value of the Northwest Hydro Systems for supporting the integration of California and Oregon renewables at a lower cost and with a higher degree of reliability than, for example, assuming that you'll have 5 million dispatchable EVs charging during the daytime and unlimited low-cost battery storage deployed across your entire state. Unfortunately, the current ISO market design does not offer an opportunity to participate, let alone be successful, for many of the entities in the Northwest who would otherwise like to discuss how to make their dispatchable hydroelectric generation capacity available to California utilities to assist you in achieving your state policy goals. I will also say, just as an aside, I think we need to remember that in these very divisive times, words matter, rhetoric matters. I hope that as we all move forward, we're able to politely and professionally agree where we can and disagree where we must, but continue to maintain a shared commitment to mutual respect and our collective interest in successfully addressing the challenges that climate change will bring to the people we serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other public comments from anyone in the room? Is there anyone on the line? No. Okay. So, no further public comments. Let's transition to the dais. I'm sort of interested in people's closing thoughts, next steps.
Thanks, everyone, for very, very constructive dialogue. The next steps are to continue to get public comment. As I said, there's a workshop in Denver next week, and we have the docket open for further public comment. There's a lot to digest here. We'll continue to refine the proposal. Please be as concrete as possible, as Chair Weisenmuller suggested, about what things you think should be changed and how. And we're going to have another couple of months of public dialogue and interchange on the scope, timing, and details about the proposal. So thank you very much.
I don't have anything to add.
Thank you very much to everybody who participated. The comments are extremely useful. I was here mostly to listen, and there are a few takeaways that I have that I believe that we can focus on a little bit more. With regards to the stakeholder process, yes, I agree with Mark Smith. Maybe it sucks, but it is one of the best we have. We are proud that we do enable, to the extent possible, have a varied amount of comments. We make sure as a board that staff responds to these comments, that we follow through. We've often sent back items to be analyzed even more and to bring us additional updates on a periodic basis. So we believe that is a process where we try to be as inclusive as we can, but certainly would appreciate comments on how to improve it, and we can always improve and realize that that's a possibility. Also, with respect to representation on the transitional committees, I agree with Allison, Clemens, and Rachel Gold that there should be representation of entities and a varied amount of entities. We have discussed those issues. Maybe not the traditional suspects that have traditionally participated, but we should be as inclusive as possible in terms of communities that may not have been around the table, and including in that respect, there have been items by communities from high tech. say that they would like to be involved, that this is actually an IT solution to a very large extent, and they would like to have a greater role and participate in the processes. So we should maybe figure out a way to outreach to them as well. So by all means, we're open to suggestions, to comments. As I said, we'll keep a close eye on it and make sure that we move forward expeditiously. Of course, the perfect is the enemy of the good, but we'll try to be as close to perfect as we can.
Okay. Very good. I would note, for the record, that Carl Zakella was on the transitional committee.
Yes.
And one of the things that was really great was that Carl took it upon himself to have precisely the perfect, the good or very good public process, stakeholder process, and sort of was going through very carefully, reading all the comments, grouping them, coming up with, making sure that we consider those. So again, if anyway, Carl can either participate in this one or someone similar to make sure that the NGO, as an NGO, making sure that it was a very good process for that is important. A couple of things. I mean, obviously, the governance issue is one of the key issues that we're trying to deal with, trying to tee it up. The basic question on timing, is that I think, as I understand, it's not as much the ISO saying we got to do it fast as here's the Pacific Corp situation with the various states and that driving it. Now, having said that, ultimately Pacific Corp is going to have to do some sort of filing with the various states showing the cost and benefits for that state of participation. So there's a lot of work to go on, and certainly as sooner we get sort of a realistic assessment, the better on the timing. But again, I think, as Foster said, ideally we're looking for not the how do we throw up enough roadblocks that this thing just dies to, what do we really need to do right? What's the timing? How do we sequence it? And so a lot of thought on that would be good. I'm going to say in some respects stray comment, but certainly Seattle City Light triggered it. One is I always spend a lot of time looking at California and Germany, as do you. And when you look at the two, Germany's definition of renewables includes large hydro. So if you do apples to apples, we're sort of at a higher level of renewables than Germany is. But when you go through that, the issues they're facing, which I think are starting to become more prevalent in the West, is as we add more renewables, we're driving down wholesale prices. And we're going to just keep adding more renewables. So this is the bottom line message to anyone who's not part of, and so that means it's going to force some rethinking of arrangements. And certainly you have Seattle City Light, if the various hydro resources can be helping us deal with the neck of the duck curve, or even the belly. I mean, that would be huge. But I think in terms of looking at your future, status quo operation is not really viable, for many of the, and again, I tend to look more California, but as you look at the implications throughout the West, it's certainly going to require changes, and this is certainly a good step in those changes. Also, in the German context, obviously, Agora was the one who first used the metaphor for these sort of grid regional approaches as storage, but storage in the grid, as opposed to batteries or flywheels or whatever. But Angelina probably knows they write very elegant, poetic stuff, along with strong technical analysis. And finally, I would just note, and this is the basic issue, the real issue to keep everyone focused on is greenhouse gas emissions in California. And when you do that for the power sector, I mean, again, basic facts you should remember is, A, transportation is double the power sector. So we got to move on transportation. The power sector at this point, the last Air Board statistics, which were 2013, are that the power sector is 20% below 1990 levels. And obviously the AB32 goal is to get to 1990 levels by 2020, obviously with the governor's goal in AB and 350, we're shooting for much deeper reductions. But at least at this point, along with keeping an eye on the power sector, and again, I always get people confused saying, well, let's look at the gas number or why aren't the nuclear numbers going up or why this or that. But the real key metric is greenhouse gas emissions. And that's something more and more we have to look at as a state, and certainly each of the utilities in California has to, public and private, and certainly all the CCAs have to be looking at what are we doing to drive down greenhouse gas emissions. And certainly, I think this is a tool to do it, but you know, certainly, again, we're going to need a lot more creativity and imagination to deal with the climate challenge of climate. And on that note, I just want to hit that, just so everyone knows, at this point, we're facing a heat storm, or at least high temperature in Southern California next week. Actually, it's through a lot of the Southwest, 100 degrees in Los Angeles. I think we may or may not set records in Phoenix. I mean, again, nobody really knows, but it's certainly a good time this weekend when you go home to put LEDs in. If you could do more than LEDs, to start thinking of thermostats, and you know, certainly if we do call flex alerts, we really need people to step forward and help. You know, raising thermostats, unnecessary lighting, appliances. I remember at one point when California was going through outages, there was like 1,000 megawatts of loads was clothes dryers. I mean, why in the hell you need clothes dryers on a hot summer afternoon, you know, at peak time? It's like, you know, you can do it other periods of the time. So anyway, we're going to need people to be, if the weather forecast holds out the way it now looks, and we do get the flex alerts, we're going to certainly need everyone to step forward and help us get through. And certainly energy efficiency is a good way to do that. You know, it saves money, it saves air pollution, and it saves greenhouse gas. So, please. Anyway, again, thanks for your being here today, and encourage written comments. And look forward to seeing at least, hopefully, I don't know if any of you are going to Denver, but next time we meet on the 350 studies.